sahanavavatu, sahanau bhunaktu, sahaviryan karavavahai, tejasvinavadi tamastuma vidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shanti. Om jaya shri krishna chaitanya prabhu nityananda. Shri Advaita Gadadhara Srivasari Gaur Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna 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 Hare Hare. Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare.
Okay, here we found the lost pages. They've been switched. Okay. Then 53. He who during 100 years annually offers a horse sacrifice, and who entirely abstains from meat, obtain the same reward for their meritorious conduct. So that means the person who does 100 ashwamedha yagyas, that entitles him to come to the platform of Indra, and the person who just remains a vegetarian get the same benefit.
All vegetarians can become Indra?
Hare Krishna. I don't know. Maybe. Fifty-four. By subsisting on pure fruit and roots, by eating food fit for ascetics in the forest, one does not gain so great a reward as by entirely avoiding the use of flesh. Mihi. Mam saha. Well, I guess that's what in the grammar it comes out. Mam saha, manksha. So that means me, mam, sa, he. Will devour in the next world, whose flesh I eat in this life. The wise declare this to be the real meaning of the word flesh, manksha. Okay. Then so much on someone dies and how long it takes to become pure. The knowledge of Brahman, austerities, fire, holy food, earth, restraint of the mind, water, smearing with cow dung, the wind, sacred rites, the sun, and time are the purifiers of corporeal beings. Among all modes of purification, purity in the acquisition of wealth is declared to be the best. For he who is pure in gain, for he is pure who gains wealth with clean hands, not he who purifies himself with earth and water. So if someone follows their duties, whatever is according to their van and ashram, one who follows that properly and gains by that, then that is considered the best purity. This is, of course, the material. It means the best is the chanting. The learned are, that comes up. That has already been discussed before. The learned are purified. 107. The learned are purified by a forgiving disposition. Those who have committed forbidden actions by liberality, secret sinners by muttering sacred texts, and those who best know the Veda by austerity. By earth and water is purified what ought to be made pure, a river by its current, a Brahman by abandoning the world, sannyas. The body is cleansed by water, the mind is purified by truthfulness, the individual soul by sacred learning and austerities, the intellect by true knowledge. Thus the precise rules for purification of the body have been declared. Hear now the decision of the law regarding the purification of the various inanimate things. Pages are mixed up. So 112. Here we go. Hello. The wise ordain that all objects made of metal, gems, and anything made of stone are to be cleansed with ashes, earth, and water. A golden vessel which shows no stains becomes pure with water alone. Likewise, what is produced in water, as shells and coral, what is made of stone and silver vessel are not, and a silver vessel not encased. So gold, shells, coral, stone, and silver are cleansed just with water, if they have no stains. Otherwise, you have to use something to get off the stains. From the union of fire and water arose glittering gold and silver. Those two, therefore, are best purified by the elements from which they sprang. Copper, iron, brass, pewter, tin, and lead must be cleansed as may be suitable for each particular clay by alkaline substances, acids, or water. The purification prescribed for all sorts of liquids is by passing two blades of kusa grass through them, for solid things by sprinkling them with water, for objects made of wood by planing them. Yeah, because ghee will be purified by taking the blades and dipping in, or by you put them across and then you pour the ghee into the pot. Like you have the pot and you put kusa across and then you pour it over the blades of grass. The charo and the spoons called shuk and shuva must be cleansed with hot water. Likewise, the wooden sword called suya, the winnowing basket surpa, the cart for bringing the grain, the pestle, and the mortar. So they're all with hot water. The sword that's used in the wooden sword, that's for drawing lines and that in the yajna. The manner of purifying large quantities of grain and of cloth is to sprinkle them with water. But the purification of small quantities is prescribed to take place by washing them. Skins and objects made of split cane must be cleansed like clothes. This is split cane, these mats, sikalpati. Vegetables, roots, and fruits like grain. So that's washing. So skins and that can be washed with whatever you use to wash clothes. I guess because before they didn't use detergent. They would use those, what do you call that? Was that Rita or something? It's soap bubble. It's a seed, you know, what do you call it? Yeah, but it's used specifically for washing wool, silk, like that. So you'd probably use that. Or just wash it in water. Silk and woolen stuffs with alkaline earth. Blankets with pounded arishta fruit. That must be the one I'm talking about. Amsupatas with bale fruit. What an Amsupata is. Supanis determines soapberry tree. As it means, according to cloth made with thinned bark. I guess we don't have to worry about that, huh? Some say it's upper garments. Really? You ever cleaned your fine saris with bale fruit? Some commentators say that. Okay. Guess you could try it. Linen cloth with a paste of yellow mustard. A man who knows the law must purify conch shells, horn, bone, and ivory like linen cloth. That would be with yellow mustard. Or a mixture of cow urine and water. Okay. Grass, wood, and straw become pure by being sprinkled with water. A house by sweeping and smearing it with cow dung or whitewash. An earthen vessel by a second burning. An earthen vessel which has been defiled by spirituous liquor, urine, odor, salva, pus, or blood cannot be purified by by another burning. So that must be thrown out. Saliva, that means if it's been eaten out of or anything, then it has to be thrown.
If you use a clay pot, say cooking, then you wash it.
Yeah.
And then you.
Then you don't have to. That you just use. This would mean.
First time.
An earthen vessel by a second burning. Let's see what would be. Let's say if you have a water pot and then something like prashad gets in it and that, then you would have to wash it and then burn it again. But if you're using it for cooking, then naturally by putting on the fire, it gets burnt again. That makes sense. Land is purified by the following five modes, namely by sweeping, by smearing it with cow dung, by sprinkling it with cow's urine or milk, by scraping, and by cows staying on it during a day and night. I think also in the Pancharatra mentions that you sprinkle water and then sweep. That's also because it keeps the dust down. Because otherwise, if you just sweep, sometimes the dust rises. And then you finish and it'll go again. So if you sprinkle water first, then you get both. But the principle is the sweeping is what purifies the earth. Food which has been pecked at by birds. Oh, we've lost again. 125. Here we are. Food which has been pecked at by birds, smelt at by cows, touched with foot, sneezed on, or defiled by hair insects becomes pure by scattering earth over it. I guess you don't bother eating it. Yeah, because it... Huh? But it says food which has been pecked at by... I don't know, maybe it does. It's touched with the foot, sneezed on, or defiled by hair, insects, becomes pure by scattering earth over it. Maybe you scatter earth and then wash it. But it doesn't say washing. I don't know. Let's see, what is that? 125. By birds, parrots, and the like, not by crows. By parents alike, not by crows, vultures, or other impure ones. Touch with the foot means, according to me, blown upon by the mouth or dusted with a dress. Moved by the wind, cloth to fill the light, according to defile the dust. Defiled by the dust of a broom or of the air moved by the wings of a bird. It still doesn't give enough. As long as the foul smell does not leave an object defiled by impure substances and the stain caused by them does not disappear, so long must earth and water be applied in cleansing inanimate things. The gods declare three things to be pure to Brahmins: that on which no taint is visible, that which has been washed with water, and what has been commended as pure by the word of a Brahmana. Water is sufficient in quantity in order to slake the thirst of a cow, possessing the proper smell, color, and taste, and unmixed with impure substances, is pure if it is collected on pure ground. How much does it take to slake the thirst of a cow? One bucket. Water is sufficient. The hand of an artisan is always pure, so is every vendable commodity exposed for sale in the market, and food obtained by begging, which a student holds in his hand, is always fit for use. That is the settled rule. Because the artisan himself may not be clean, but their hands are considered clean, so that they've dealt with it and then they give it to you. It doesn't mean you can touch any other part of their body. But if you see the only thing that they touch it with is their hand, if you come and they're sitting on it or standing on it, then you'll go to the next vendor. Mm-hmm. But if you haven't seen any of that, if you just see that they're touching with their hand and you get it, or they bring you things or that, their hands are considered clean. So if that or you touch it or that, then there's no problem. The vendable commodity exposed for sale in the market, like Prabhupada mentioned, like you're traveling on the trains, you see them cook it. It's exposed, you see it, then it's considered pure. You know. Food obtained by begging, which a student holds in his hand, is always fit for use. Means, I guess, is if it's more than that, they start sticking it in, you know, bags, and this, then it loses its purity. But whatever they have, whatever their bowl is, if they go out and collect that much is pure. It's always fit for use. That is the settled rule.
Prabhupada also mentioned when he was talking about buying things for the deities, that it may not always be pure, but if you go and buy it, then it's considered pure.
It becomes purified by the exchange of money. That's specifically that's also in foodstuffs like that. It becomes purified of the karma, though the consciousness is there. Like that. Cooked things always carry consciousness. Like that. Okay, we have one time. Okay. 1:30. The mouth of a woman is always pure, likewise a bird when he causes a fruit to fall. A calf is pure on the flowing of milk, and a dog is pure when he catches a deer. So I guess that's the only time you can pet a dog, is when he's just caught a deer. 1:31.
What does it mean that a woman's mouth is pure?
Bond. It doesn't say here. I think maybe the breath and all that kind of thing is not is there. Because otherwise, many times the brahmacharis, when they come to the teacher, like in the Upanayanam and other things, they come and put their hand in front of their mouth. Mm-hmm. You know. Like a cow is pure everywhere but the mouth. Mm-hmm. Mouth is not pure. The other animals it is, like horses or this or that. You know, if you're walking and then they touch you with their nose or something, you're not contaminated. The cow, the whole body is pure except the mouth. Like that. That's why something touched or sniffed by a cow is not considered edible. Like that. Because some story goes back with, I think, Sita Devi. And the cow didn't tell the truth. So then her mouth was then said to be impure. Like that. Yeah, so I guess the calf after drinking the milk is pure. A bird when he causes a fruit to fall. Okay. All those cavities of the body which lie above the navel are pure. but those which are below the navel are impure, as well as the excretions that fall from the body. Flies, drops of water, a shadow, a cow, a horse, the rays of the sun, dust, earth, the wind, and fire, one must know to be pure to the touch. So if a fly comes and lands, you don't have to go wash. In order to cleanse the organs, and cleaning the body, then is water and mud, water and earth. Oh, I see. Yeah, so any of the things that come out of the body then has to be cleaned with water and mud. Oh, so this is out of here. Sanatana Goswami quotes this. Just putting mud, using mud for cleaning, mud and water. Then one should always, and purification, one should always say Achman after using the toilet or before reciting the Veda, and always before he takes food. It says the Shudras who live according to the law shall each month shave their heads. Drops of water from the mouth which do not fall on a limb do not make a man impure, nor the hair of the mustache entering the mouth, nor what adheres to the teeth. Okay, so this is, thus the rules of personal purification for men of all castes and for those and those for cleaning inanimate things have been fully declared to you. Here now the duties of women. So this was for everybody, these different things. It wasn't just for the Brahmins. These are general rules. Only that thing on the Snataka, then that was specifically for Brahmins. 137. Okay, now we're going through here. 147. By a girl, by a young woman, or even by an aged one, nothing must be done independently, even in her own house. In childhood, a female must be subject to her father, in youth to her husband, when her lord is dead to her sons. A woman must never be independent. She must not seek to separate herself from her father, husband, or sons. By leaving them, she would make both her own and her husband's family contemptible. She must always be cheerful, clever in the management of her household affairs, careful in cleaning her utensils, and economical in expenditure. Him to whom her father may give her, or her brother with the father's permission, she shall obey as long as he lives, and when he is dead, she must not insult his memory. For the sake of procuring good fortune to brides, the recitation of benedictory text, Svastyayana, and the sacrifice to the Lord of creatures, Prajapati, are used at weddings. But the betrothal by the father or guardian is the cause of the husband's dominion over his wife. Good fortune, there's a benedictory text. The husband who wedded her with sacred texts always gives happiness to his wife, both in season and out of season, in this world and in the next. It says, though destitute of virtue, or seeking pleasure elsewhere, or devoid of good qualities, yet a husband must be constantly worshipped as a god by a faithful wife. No sacrifice, no vow, no fast must be performed by women apart from their husbands. If a wife obeys her husband, she will for that reason alone be exalted in heaven. A faithful wife who desires to dwell after death with her husband must never do anything that might displease him who took her hand, whether he be alive or dead. At her pleasure, let her emaciate her body by living on pure flowers, roots, and fruits, but she must never mention the name of another man after her husband has died. Until death, let her be patient of hardships, self-controlled and chaste, and strive to fulfill that most excellent duty which is prescribed for wives who have one husband only. Many thousands of brahmanas who are chaste from their youth have gone to heaven without continuing their race. A virtuous wife who, after the death of her husband, constantly remains chaste, reaches heaven, though she may have no son, just like those chaste men. Because the normal thing is that grihastas, that when they have the son, then it's the son that does the rituals and all that, then they're able to go to the heavenly planets. Because if they don't do the ritual, then they can't go. But it mentions here that the Naistika brahmacharis, that they, just by following their brahmacharya and that, then they'll automatically be elevated. So even though they don't have the son. You know, so many times the grihastas, they say, well, how will anything go right unless you have a son? But, you know, they many times say this to someone who decides not to get married. But then just by that proper restraint, then one goes to the upper planets. Or, you know, one gets it helps in one steadying one's mind for going back to Godhead. But it mentions a virtuous wife, to the death of her husband, like that, he may have problems, but she, by remaining chaste, she'll go. Like that, just by remaining that chastity. So she gets the same benefit as a Naistika brahmachari. Like that. The Vedas always balance it. The new modern twilight word.
The whole picture?
No, not the whole picture. It's a new twilight word. Technical words for words that have double meanings. Like that. Oh no, what is it? It's not a twilight word, it's the new speak. What is it? No, it's a term.
Ambiguous?
No, it's a new, it's one of the, it's always used. Oh, equal opportunity. There must be equal spiritual opportunity for the men and women. So the Vedas have already worked that in. But one has to know how it works. Just like we reading the other day is that the woman, the many times they complain they can't do personal service for the guru. But it said just by doing all the duties in the house, serving the husband, they get the same benefit. Like that. So the brahmachari sometimes would be able to be with the guru, but the wife is always able to do those duties in the house. So it's very rare that you find a brahmachari that got, you know, 20 years, 30 years, like that. Association where they could do personal service like that. But the wife gets that.
By living with the husband, she gets the benefit of living with the guru.
Huh.
By doing service like cooking, cleaning. Huh. She gets the benefit of performing sacrifices.
Agnihotra. Yeah. Means the daily Agnihotra is done just by doing the household duties. Like that. You know, sometimes the ladies go, how come we can't do the yajnas? Just by doing the, taking care of the house, cleaning the house and doing those duties, you get the same benefit as doing the Agnihotra. Like that. And the personal service. So it's all worked in. So here, the virtuous wife gets the same benefit as the Naistika Brahmachari. The husband doesn't. Right? He didn't have the son. He's got problems. But she doesn't. Like that. But then the downside. 161. But a woman who, from a desire to have offspring, violates her duty towards her deceased husband, brings on herself disgrace in this world and loses her place with her husband in heaven. Offspring begotten by another man is here not considered lawful, nor does offspring begotten on another man's wife belong to the begetter, nor is a second husband anywhere prescribed for virtuous women. So this one's not used in probably mentions in the Kali Yuga, this one. Begetting offspring in another man's wife. Then, here, two things. It belongs to whoever the wife is married to, it's their child. Mm-hmm. Like that. Someone can't come and claim like that. Or in the previous ages, if the husband wasn't able to bear children, then the husband's brother could do that, like Vyasadeva did for his brother. Like that, but they're considered their children. Like that. What was his name? Vichitravirya, right? So Dhritarashtra is known as the son of Vichitravirya. But we see that many times that would be used as something to just chide him when it wasn't just a normal thing of, the great son of Vichitravirya, but when it was being used sarcastically, and they said, the son of Vichitravirya has spoken. And then everybody knows that, he's not. Mm-hmm. Like that. But he's not considered Vyasadeva's son. You'll never hear it said that he's Vyasadeva's son. Mm-hmm. Though Vyasadeva begot him. Parapurva. By violating her duty towards her husband, a wife is disgraced in this world. After death, she enters the womb of a jackal and is tormented by diseases. She who controls her thoughts, words, and deeds, never slights her lord, resides after death with her husband in heaven and is called a virtuous wife. So the principle is that he has to work for her. It means he has to do all his particular duties and whatever it takes to get him wherever he wants to go, where his goal is. A particular heavenly planet, go back to Godhead like this. The wife, if she simply is chaste to the husband, if he goes back to Godhead, she goes. Right? Even if she's not a great devotee, she'll go. If she thinks of the husband, at the time of death, she'll go back to Godhead. So actually the opportunities are greater. The husband has to think of Krishna. Then he can go back to Godhead. If he thinks of the wife, he won't go back to Godhead. He'll take birth here again. The wife can think of Krishna or think of the husband. And if he's gone, she'll just go. Like that. So it's a very... So that actually... It's unequal. We should complain. Yes. Then that won't, because she's being virtuous, she'll relieve him from that. Also, another thing that we went through before is that the sins of the wife go to the husband. But the sins of the husband don't go to the wife. Like that. So, in some things, it's not equal. The women actually have a better deal. Like that. A twice-born man versed in the sacred law shall burn a wife of equal caste who conducts herself thus and dies before him with the sacred fires used for the Agnihotra and with the sacrificial implements. In other words, a Dharmapatni that dies before him, then he will use the sacred fires. It means he'll remove the ones for burning bodies, because otherwise you leave the ones for burning bodies. You just start the fire. And what will manifest will be there's two fires that burn bodies. But when you do an Agnihotra, you chant mantras to remove those, like that. So in other words, because of the Dharmapatni's purity, like that, then she is like dealt with in such an honorable way. Yeah, so this would be then after that. Having thus, at the funeral, given the sacred fires to his wife, who dies before him, he may marry again and again kindle the fires. So because then the sacred fires will come again. If he doesn't, then he can't do that. You know? In other words, he has to have used sacred fires to burn his wife, because she represented Dharma. Then only then he can again can marry. That's there, that's in using, but still, in the fires there's 18 forms of fire. Agni has 18 forms. So two of those are for burning bodies. So when you start the fire for doing the yajna, the first thing you do is, once the fire is there, you remove some fire from that, chanting the mantras for the fires for burning bodies, and remove that and throw that at some distance. So then you're left with only 16 options of fires. Then depending on which one you want, you call that one. Like this. So this means you would remove those first. So you're only dealing with those fires. So because he's done that, then, and that wife has been respected in that way, then he can then use those sacred fires for marriage. Because you can't do the marriage without the sacred fire. So if he hasn't done that, then he can't perform You can't do that again and be again married. You know, like Lord Chaitanya, when his wife died before, then he would have to do this, then he could marry Vishnupriya. Otherwise it wasn't allowed. According to the preceding rules, he must never neglect the five great sacrifices, and having taken a wife, he must dwell in his own house during the second period of his life. You want to say something?
I wanted to ask about cooking.
Cooking.
Because we don't remove the fires from burning bodies.
There, it's not so strict in there. Though in Puri, they do that and do a small yajna on the fire. And then they cook. But I've only heard of that in Puri. I haven't heard that anywhere else that they deal with that. They just use the general fire. Like that. But I haven't. You know. Because fire is pure. It's just a matter for the Agnihotra, you make it more pure. Mm-hmm. So it's the fire is already pure, but you bring out its more greater purity. And then after that, then many times then they do samskars for the fire. Like that. They actually go through and do it from birth on up to Upanayanam. They just have a mantra for each, and then he goes through all the samskars. So then he's appeared, so he's born, and then you do the samskaras and that makes even more pure. So it's a matter of the fire is pure, and then you make make ceremonially pure, like that. So for cooking, it's not so important, though they do it in Puri. But here it's like you're ceremonially making it pure for the wife who's done before. But this means the wife it says conduct yourself thus, means as from what was mentioned before. You know. It means if she wasn't properly behaved, then it's not important. You know. But if she was, that has to be recognized. Because the point is a woman always has to be respected by the father, by the son, by the husband. They must be. You can't those who are Dharma Patnis, they can't be disrespected. If they are, it'll destroy the whole dynasty. Not even just the family, the dynasty will be wiped out. Like we see Duryodhana disrespected Draupadi, who was chaste, like that. And he probably didn't think much of it because he's thinking, here's a lady who's married five husbands. But he doesn't understand. She's Indrani and they're Indra. So there's no... These things don't apply for the demigods. So her chastity destroyed the whole dynasty. The whole Kuru dynasty was wiped out. Mm-hmm. Same with Sita. Ravana, everyone was wiped out. His whole kingdom, everything. Everything is destroyed. You know, like this. So the chaste woman can never be disrespected because the potency is so much. As we see here, is she has the same potency as a Naistika Brahmachari. The Naistika Brahmachari, just by being Naistika, at death will automatically, even if he does nothing else, he doesn't do one yogi or anything for going to heaven plants, he'll be elevated to the Brahmaloka. Just automatically, by being Naistika. So the woman, if she is also in this way chaste, then she will automatically be elevated. Like that. It's powerful. Mm-hmm. That's why the boy is trained in Brahmacharya, the woman in chastity. Mm-hmm. Has the same equal power. Mm-hmm. Like that. So it can't be disrespected. Just like you can't disrespect, you know, a Brahmachari. Like that. They have to be, they're protected. Mm-hmm. Means they're like the children of the grihasthas. So in the same way, the women must be protected by the grihasthas, by their own family, by the community, like that. Because it's the same principle that's going on.
That's why Vamana appeared as a brahmachari.
Yeah, Vamana.
And he went and begged for 3 steps of land. And about Draupadi.
Speak more loud.
About Draupadi. Huh. Gaura Govinda Maharaj, he said that she would spend a certain time with each husband, and no other husband could disturb during that time. Hmm. Otherwise, we'd have to go into exile. Hmm. And he said, at the end of that time, I can't remember if it was a year or some months. 3, 5. Anyway, at the end of that time, she would enter into fire, like Sita entered into fire after being taken by Ravana, where she was born from fire.
Oh yeah, that's right.
So she would enter into fire and come out again new. Huh. And then she would go with her next husband at that time.
Okay. So
then she would enter into fire again and come out new. And also prove her chastity, but also come out new.
I guess that's a way then ladies could do it. They want to keep more than one. They just have to be able to enter into fire after each one. Yeah. Yeah. And that story, how she was born from fire? You know the story? That you've heard? Basically is that Maharaj Draupad, after he was insulted by Drona, that he came and sent the Pandavas and they caught him and then captured him and brought him before Drona, and Drona says, okay, you know, now you said you cannot be friends with someone who is not equal. So it says, now we have captured you, so we're giving you half of your kingdom back, I'm keeping the other half. So now we're equal. So now we have to be friends. You know? But then Draupad, being a Kshatriya, when they're insulted, they can't forget these things. So he decided that he's going to have a child who can kill Drona. So then he went to do that Putukameshti Yajna. And then generally what happens at that point is then from the fire, then they get some sweet rice or a fruit or something that is there, and then the wife, by accepting that, then she has a child. So then the queen was there, the king was there, and they're going in long proceedings, these things. The Vedic yajnas aren't short, they're quite long. So as they went along, then she had at one time got up and kind of, you know, how you say, she had gone out and all this. And then the moment came when it was time, she had to be there, and the living entity or somethings were in the fire, and there was something they were just going to transfer straight to the wife, and like this. And they kind of like said, okay, you know, where's the wife? And it's kind of like everyone starts frantically looking around for her and all this and that, and she had been chewing some pan, and then she wanted to wash her mouth and all this. And so then it got delayed, and they say the souls are here. You know, they're going to go away. What are you going to do? So then they ask, well, can't you just bring them straight out of the fire?
So then... they got the sweet rice.
Huh?
I think they got the sweet rice and they threw it back into the fire.
They threw it back into the fire, the sweet rice. Oh. Yeah. Well, then they did something and chanted some more mantras. And then I think out of the fire rode Vistadumna on a chariot. He came out and rode around the room, you know, in the air, like that. So everyone thought, this is it. Then suddenly they noticed that out of the fire rose Draupadi. And then she came out. Because she was the cause of the war that Drishtadyumna could kill Drona, like that. So she was, when she says she was born out of the fire, means she came out of the fire. She was not born like that. Because she's the Swarga Lakshmi. So Swarga Lakshmis aren't. Lakshmi is not born like that. You always find her in, you know, lotuses or, you know, in the ground when you plow the field and, you know, like this. So she came out of fire like that. So the Vedic culture doesn't allow that a chaste woman can be insulted. Otherwise it destroys everything. And at the same time, is because of that chastity and that mood of dharma, that they just do these things like that. So that is their, like, their great vow of their chastity, just like the brahmachari, because of his vow, then so much power is there. So the wife, by her vow, then is that powerful. So factually, in one sense, she's more powerful than the husband. The husband is powerful as a brahmachari and becomes powerful again as a sannyas, like that. But the woman, due to her chastity, then is always powerful. Are there any questions on these? Because then we go into the next chapter, which is Vanaprastha. Chapter 6. A twice-born Snataka, who has thus lived according to the law in the order of householders, may, taking a firm resolution and keeping his organs in subjection, dwell in the forest duly, observing the rules given below. When a householder sees his skin wrinkled and his hair white and the sons of his sons, then he may resort to the forest. It means it's, you know, it's getting old. Problem is sometimes now devotees may have wrinkled skin and gray hair, but, you know, they're still on their first 3-year-old daughter. You know. So, just delays things a little bit.
The Bhagavatam says that if a man who's old has a child, he'll be a boy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's always a good thing to keep in mind. Nanda Baba was even surprised. Is that when the man gets older, then it's generally always he'll have daughters. Because he becomes weaker.
And Nanda Baba had
daughter. Yeah, Nanda Baba had a daughter. You know? So then he was surprised when it was a son, because he was older. Like that. Though Advaitacharya was older and he had sons. But of course, he's Mahavishnu, so one has to, like that. Abandoning all food raised by cultivation and all his belongings, he may depart into the forest, either committing his wife to his sons or accompanied by her. Taking with him the sacred fire, the implements required for domestic sacrifices, he may go forth from the village into the forest and reside there, duly controlling his senses. So in other words, going to the forest, like Prabhupada says, for us, the Gaudiya Vaishnavas, then we retire to the forest, like that. He says, we do. We retire to the forest. The Vanaprasthas must retire to the forest of Vrindavan, or the forest of Lord Chaitanya, you know, Mayapur. So they retire, huh? Yeah, or preaching. Because it says here, the implements of, how do you say? The implements required for sacrifice. So that means that the performance of the Harinam Sankirtan must be there. So that would be the preaching or the, you know, in some way doing some service in the Dham, but the sadhana and everything. So that becomes the, so whatever is necessary for that, then they can take with them. Let him offer those great five sacrifices according to the rule with various kinds of pure food fit for ascetics, or with herbs, roots of fruit. So we discussed before, the five great sacrifices for us is accomplished by chanting the holy name. Chanting the holy name, ooh, where are those? Okay. Ahuta is not offered in the fire. It means huta is offered in the fire. Ahuta is not offered in the fire. Is muttering of Vedic texts. So by chanting the holy name, by reciting Srimad Bhagavatam, like that. That's the first of the great sacrifices. Huta, the burnt oblation. So for us, that is the Sankirtan mission. Prahuta. Okay. Then, how do you say? I say Prahuta. That is taken care of. The Bhutas are already taken care of by worshipping Krishna. Brahmanyahuta. Offering in the digestive fire of Brahmanas. So then, how do you say? Associating with devotees, serving devotees, offering prasad to devotees, then that takes care of that. And tarpana, then the forefathers, that's also taken care of by chanting. By chanting, then you please Krishna, so that takes care of the demigods, the forefathers, and the, how do you say? And the ghosts. So all that's done. So in other words, by associating with devotees, performing Sankirtan, and by hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, then these already have taken care of all the five sacrifices, the five great sacrifices. Let him wear a skin or a tattered garment. Let him bathe in the evening or in the morning, and let him always wear his hair in braids. That means matted. The hair on his body, his beard and his nails being unclipped. So the whole idea of the vanaprastha is one learns to become detached from the body. Now after a lifetime, so, you know, the hippies would think, well, this is fine. You know, this is, they're already living like this. But the point is after living a life where you're so used to cleanliness, you cannot tolerate being unclean. You just can't tolerate it. So the growing of the hair, not cutting the nails, all these things, it's very disturbing. So then one learns to see the body itself is producing all this dirt, right? The hair and the nails are the waste product of the bones. The bones maintain themselves, and then they throw off waste product, and that's hair and nails. That's why the hair and nails, like bones, don't dissolve, don't disintegrate, because they're coming from the bones. So, you know, we think these are so beautiful, nice, and all this, but then we start to see all this, the whole body is just being, you know, rather objectionable. So that's the whole purpose of the vanaprastha, is to completely detach yourself from the body. But that happens because they have been able to follow the vows of cleanliness very nicely. So then it works very easy. If one doesn't know how to be clean, it's harder to become detached from the body. because he doesn't really realize how dirty the body is, because he never thought it was dirty in the first place, you know, therefore to clean it. So then when you then you don't clean, then you understand. So that's the purpose of it. So the vanaprastha, in other words, he should understand in his chanting and all these that the body is not clean. Let him perform the Bali offering with such food as he eats and give alms according to his ability. So still, he is giving in charity and following these things. Let him honor those who come to his hermitage with alms consisting of water, roots, and fruits. Though what it may be very simple. He may not be giving, you know, pasta and all these things, but just some water, some fruits, some roots. Let him always be industrious to privately reciting the Veda. Let him be patient of hardships, friendly towards all, of collected mind, ever liberal, and never a receiver of gifts, and compassionate towards all living creatures. So he still doesn't receive gifts. I mean, now here he specifically doesn't take gifts. He just takes what he can collect here and there and like that. And here again we see this. Oops. Here again we see this point. Let him be patient of hardship, friendly towards all. Because this being friendly towards all is a very essential element in developing pure devotion. Is that one is very kind and very understands all living entities coming from Krishna. Patient of hardships. He has to understand the material world. One is understanding his body is not a wonderful thing. And the material world itself is full of hardships. He's not trying to overcome those hardships. He understands that it's like this. Let him eat vegetables that grow on dry land or in water, flowers, roots, and fruits, the productions of pure trees, and oils extracted from forest fruits. Let him avoid honey, mushrooms growing on the ground or elsewhere, the vegetables called bustrina. What is it, bustrina? Horseradish. Hmm. Wow. Nokshan. Oh yeah, and this also includes mushrooms that grow on trees. So no bamboo fungus soup. So you'd have to cut out a lot of Chinese cooking. Okay. He may eat either which has been cooked with fire or which has been ripened by time. So it says here, he may either collect enough for one day, or for a month, or gather what suffices for 6 months, or for a year. I guess this is the principle, if you go out and collect for 1 or 2 months and then live off that for the rest of the year or something. Mm-hmm. Having collected food according to his ability, he may either eat at night only, or in the daytime only, or at every fourth meal time, or at every eighth. In other words, he's going to restrict his... Oh, at every fourth meal time, or at every eighth. What's this? That would be the night. Fourth, eighth. Yeah, it doesn't say. In other words, he should start to restrict his eating. Instead of eating many, many times. You know, instead of, you know, snack in the morning, and then a little bit of breakfast, and then the lunch, and then the evening snack, and then the dinner, and then the night snack, like this, you know. They should, like, cut it down to basically eating once a day. So eating once a day specifically means grains, like that. One can eat a meal that has grains in it once, and then you can at other times take, you know, milk or fruit, like that. And that's still considered eating once. Or one may consider eating once means once a day you only take something. Yeah, he must learn to be austere, like that. What is it that it says, the main austerity? We were reading that the other day. It was chanting, reciting the Veda or something like that.
What's reading the Veda?
Yeah, I think it was Japa. There isn't, yeah. It says, of penances I am Japa, isn't it?
Of all sacrifices.
Yeah.
The greatest sacrifice is the sacrifice of Mudra.
Of Gayatri. Gayatri, yeah. So that means that he should more and more absorb himself in chanting the holy name and in the, you know, those sacrifices. The austerity of the body, being clean, the aspects of, how you say, respectfulness to others. And that, and since we're, there's two systems also in here. This is for going out in the forest where there'll be no worship of the deity. So then there's the aspect is the brahmachari. We see he either keeps his hair, and, you know, matted hair, and doesn't shave or anything. Or they keep a clean shaven head with a sika if they're doing worship. And if they're not doing worship, then they leave the hair. So for us, we're following that system. Like in the Samaveda Upanayanam, then they shave like that. And then the others, then they don't. Other Vedas may not shave, but in the Samaveda, then we shave. So in here, then those aspects, you know, instead of going in the forest, we're practicing the austerities of proper cleanliness and that. Because it mentioned before that after, you know, using the toilet, then in Saucha Kriya, that then one cleans oneself properly. And so double that, that's the grihastha, double that's for the brahmachari, triple that's for the vanaprastha, four times that for the sannyas. But I think one place mentions sannyas means, you know, clean. Is that they're very, that's one of their main activities is cleanliness. Like that. So so for us, then these aspects then would be taking that, the cleanliness would be there, the respectfulness of others would be there, truthfulness in speaking according to the scriptures, the mind should be withdrawn from the senses. So these are all the austerities that Krishna mentions in the Gita. Austerity, the body, mind, and words. So he's supposed to become very austere. Yeah. Yeah, so it's saying he should bathe 3 times a day. No, this is just his cleanliness is austerity, like that. Because those things would go on. This is just things that would be different from the Grihastha Ashram. Generally, whatever's been spoken before, this just goes on top of that. So then the duties that were there in the household, then those things are given up. That those things that create, how you say, economic development and sense gratification, these things are given up. So those aspects. So the life becomes more simple than very clean, always absorbed in hearing, chanting, associating with devotees, and not taking means there's no over endeavor to maintain the body. The body is, it's just how much you need to for doing service, but you don't try to make oneself, fat and healthy and like this. Until one is very, independent of material things. Making no effort to procure things that give pleasure. Practicing chastity. Sleeping on the ground. Not worrying about his shelter. From brahmanas who live as ascetics, let him receive alms, barely sufficient, just how much he needs to maintain himself. Or from householders of the twice-born castes who reside in the forest. Yeah, and he must eat, be very frugal in his eating, not overeat. These and other observances must a Brahmana who dwells in the forest diligently practice, and in order to obtain complete union with the Supreme Soul, he must study the various sacred texts contained in the Upanishads. So the Upanishads then are the philosophy of the Veda. Before this, his main emphasis would have been on the study of the Brahmanas, like that, which were deal with the performance of sacrifice. How to do the yajñas and the various duties. But now it's mainly on philosophy. As well as those rites and texts which have been practiced and studied by the sages, rishis, and by Brahmana householders in order to increase their knowledge of Brahman, their austerity, and in order to sanctify their bodies. So a Brahmana, having gotten rid of his body by one of those modes practiced by the great sages, is exalted in the world of Brahman, free from sorrow and fear. But having gotten rid of the bodily consciousness, like that. But having thus passed the third part of a man's natural term of life in the forest, he may live as an ascetic during the fourth part of his existence, after abandoning all attachment to worldly objects. In other words, they can do here, it mentions here, he can do Mahaprasthan, let him walk fully determined and going straight on in a northeasterly direction, subsisting on water and air until his body sinks to rest. So at the end of when he's perfected his Vanaprastha stage, then they can either just walk in that northeasterly direction until they can't go anymore and just leave one's body in that way. Or then one can go into the fourth stage, into sannyas. Say? Northeast. I don't have my paper. Who's in the northeast?
Ishwar? Hari. Krishna.
Krishna's in the northeast.
According to Madhvacharya, it's Isha.
Uh-huh.
So for the smartest, that's Lord Shiva. But for the Madhvacharya, it's a verse, he says it's Hari, Krishna.
Oh, I see. So then Krishna, that's his direction. Vishnu stays in that direction. That's also the direction of the ego. So then the ego, the false ego, is given up. And that's what actually keeps us in the world. You give up the false ego and one's not in the material world. Oh, excuse me, I was looking in the southwest, yeah. Yeah, that's also probably an important point, is if you walk that direction, then you'll end up in the Himalayas. Otherwise, you might end up somewhere else. The Pandavas, they did that. They went in that direction. Because generally, the Kshatriyas will only go up to that third stage, up to Vanaprastha. Uh-huh. Southeast, south, north, east, northeast, Ishan. Yeah. It's Sattvagun, it's water. Yeah, the tattva is water. Color is white. It's controlled by the moon. Krishna is the deity. So those are the different aspects of that direction. Also is that for the devotee, also another aspect of for the Vaishnavas, that's the direction controlled by Yoga Maya. Like that. If one's not a devotee, it's controlled by Mahamaya. So, you know, they don't want to get out of here. So then she takes care of them. And those who do, then Purnamasi takes care of them. You, after passing from order to order, after offering sacrifices and subduing his senses, having, very nicely given alms and offerings of food, an ascetic gains bliss after death. Means he's done all those things before, then you can move on to that. When he has paid the three debts, let him apply his mind to the attainment of final liberation. He who seeks it without having paid his debts sinks downwards. So for those who are in the field of karmakanda, then they must have gone through all this, the grihastha ashram, they must have paid their debts to the forefathers, to the, you know, the sages, to, you know, all those persons, the mother and father, all those people, they would have had to have taken care. But by chanting the holy name, those debts are taken care of. When you serve Krishna, those debts are already automatically cleared. So one who is chanting, he doesn't have to worry. For him, then, going on to go for the final attainment of liberation, that's done. That's why many times when it's, you know, Hindus will hear that somebody wants to take up spiritual life, then they feel, well, you haven't done all the duties of a grihastha. So then this is improper. You have to do that first, then you can do. But if one takes up the worship of Krishna and chanting the holy name, that is automatically taken care of. So then one can immediately go for spiritual attainment, no matter what stage of life one is in. Yeah, means because the nama bas gives liberation. So all these other things of the demigods and the forefathers is well below that. That's down at the karma level. You know, we're not even talking about jnana. So already the holy name can, the nama bas can situate oneself in the, free one from the material, contamination. So can already bring about the understanding Brahma-Bhuta platform. So those are so much farther below. That's why it's said that chanting the holy name should never be thought of as just, you know, some aspect of karmakanda. It is so far beyond that it doesn't. These things are so secondary. It means you please Krishna, so all his limbs are pleased. So naturally, the demigods, they reward all the benefits. So you have to go through all those things to please them. But by worshipping Krishna, they're already pleased. So just by that act of worshipping Krishna, all those duties that you have in the realms of karma are already taken care of. So now what we're dealing with is simply the lifestyle that purifies us and frees us of material contamination. Therefore, what we take out of all this is basically just the etiquette. You know? Many times, it means the tendency is the general person will catch on the very little technical rules. But that's not the point. The point is we're attached to the body and we need to purify that. So these different rules of etiquette and how we deal then engage the body according to Krishna's rules. And we follow those rules to please Krishna. And the results of those, they're Krishna's. The body is Krishna's, the activities are Krishna's. So that means all the different activities that one would perform have a structure in which they can be formed to please Krishna. Otherwise, we may say, well, I chant Hare Krishna, but are we always able to do that? Remember all the time, we're fully absorbed in Krishna when we're passing stool. So now, if not, how are we going to engage a passing stool in Krishna's service? So that's done by properly follow the rules that go along with passing stool. You know, there's so many rules that are there. You know, the proper way of sitting, how we clean ourselves. You know, one doesn't talk, all these things. And by doing that, you're following the Lord's rules, so those become engaged. So on the basic level, then more than that, we understand that this is the way Krishna likes it. So we're doing it to please Krishna. And first we do it just because it's a rule. Then we do it because it pleases Krishna. Then we come to the stage where we're always thinking of Krishna. Like that. Till one gets to the point where, like Rishabhdev, he's so absorbed in Krishna, he doesn't notice if he's passing stool or not. So there is a practical means. The devotional process is 100% practical, and one should understand one stage and understand technically what is going on. We say I'm chanting Hare Krishna. I don't care for the rules, but we have to understand how that's working. Otherwise, to say it, you know, that's good. That some faith is there in the holy name. But we should see that if someone's saying that and all they do is chant Hare Krishna 24 hours a day and don't endeavor for anything, and whatever comes to them, they eat a little handful, and the rest of the day they just chant, then that statement is acceptable. But if they say, oh, we don't care for the rules, and then they don't bother about cleanliness, they have their nice house, they're off with their wife and all these things, and they show up at the temple now and again, and all this and that, then they are not on that platform. We chant Hare Krishna, we don't care for the rules. Because they care, it says, we chant Hare Krishna, we don't care for the rules, but I do care for a lot of other things. I care for my money, my position, my facilities, you know, like that, my respect that I get from others, you know, my sense gratification. Like that. So that has to be, it technically has to work. It actually has to function. One needs to either have, generally, the goal is to have such total faith and surrender to the name that all there is the name. Because the name is Krishna. So that's all there is. And then it's up to Krishna what goes on. But to get us to that stage, we may find we have to go through this stage of knowledge, of understanding, how it is that everything I do is connected to Krishna. And to get to that stage of knowledge, then one has to perform the activities for Krishna. So we become purified, so we're actually able to understand that knowledge. Therefore, Krishna puts this all together in the Gita as Nishkam Karma Yoga. You perform the activities in knowledge. that gives you realization. Then you can come to that platform where one is freed from all those. But as a preacher, one follows them anyway to teach example. Like that. Yes, Mati. But they didn't, Prabhupada and Bhaktisiddhanta didn't neglect any principle, not one. But devotees unknowingly neglect principles, and then they think that they're transcendentally situated. And then after 3 years you come back and see where they are. Because the preaching means is that one is doing that work, but that we always must remember is that we're not the preachers. Prabhupada and Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, they're the preachers. We're simply assisting them. So if we think, I am the preacher, then we better be the preacher. But generally we find it's much more conducive to understand I am the servant of the preacher. And so I assist them in the preaching. So my service is that aspect of preaching. Because factually in the movement, if one understands the whole movement is Lord Chaitanya's mission, then everything is preaching. Even the devotee who's just sweeping the road in Mayapur, and then people come in and look and say, wow, this place is very clean. You know, this is very nice, and they appreciate the Dham. That is also preaching. But because we are a preaching mission, we also then discriminate, I mean, we make the distinction between those who are also doing the front-line preaching, because that gets special attention. Also, those who are distributing the books and going out and meeting the people and like that. And so that is very, very important. So they're given a special position even amongst the whole mission, which is preaching. So the whole mission is preaching. But amongst those who are going out and making, how you say, absorbing themselves and thinking of ways to bring in people to Krishna consciousness, how to turn their attention from Maya and get them to take up Krishna consciousness, they're given a special position, you know, special consideration. So the whole thing is, we must understand, the whole thing is preaching. But no principles are undone. I mean, what did they neglect? What would be an example? No, but as we mentioned before, there's two systems, the matted hair, the shaved head. They both follow the shaved head. Because they follow, like Prabhupada follow, he's a Paramahamsa, but he accepted the designations of sannyas and followed that. You did not find any women servants. They were known. He may had a woman cook whose husband was the secretary, but there were never any women servants. As a sannyasi, he didn't allow it. You never can hear of one guru puja that Prabhupada accepted worship from the woman. He wouldn't do it. He was a sannyasi. He wouldn't sit in alone with a woman and talk. There always had to be someone else there, because he was a sannyasi. Because once, I think it was here in Mayapur, so one lady wanted to speak to him, and the servant and all that. He was either here or in Vrindavan. And then the servant, because they wanted to speak privately, the servant got up and walked away. Prabhupada called him back. He said, no, someone has to be here. You know, and they were thinking, oh, Prabhupada, Paramahamsa, this, that. He says, no, we're a sannyasi. So he didn't ever broke that. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, same. Lord Chaitanya, same. So even though we take them as external, like Ramananda Rai, he said, when Lord Chaitanya said, tell me what is the, you know, goal of life, then Ramananda said, Varnashram. And Lord Chaitanya said, that's external. So then many devotees take that we reject it. No, but the body is external. So the body has to run according to the Varnashram. But there's higher than that. There's higher than the body. Then there's the subtle body. Higher than that, then there's the soul, the consciousness. So he was just taking it to the point where he got to the consciousness. And then from the consciousness, then what are the levels of that? You have the material consciousness, then we got the Brahman, then Paramatma, then Bhagavan. Then we got to Bhagavan. Then what is that? Then there's Vaikuntha. Then there's, you know, the different realms there. Then in that which is highest. Then you have Vrindavan, and then you have the five rasas, and then then is the gopis. Then in the gopis, then is Radharani. Then in Radharani, then there's the highest moods of separation. Then that's what Lord Chaitanya wanted to discuss. But he never gave up, you know, what's his name? The external form, because that's the etiquette, that's the dealings. So when, what's this, Satyabhama? Jagannanda offered this nice sandalwood oil for Lord Chaitanya, like that, because that's her rasa, right? She's Satyabhama, queen of Dwarka. So here is the Dwarkadish. So she's offering sandalwood oil to Dwarkadish, but Dwarkadish is accepting the pastimes of a sannyasi. So he just says, I can't accept this. You offer this to the lamps of Lord Jagannath, like that. And he can put it in his lamps, burn it, and he'll be very pleased with the nice fragrance and all that. So then Jagannanda comes there, you know, says, you know, where's that pot of oil? Let me see it. Takes it, throws it on the ground. And he says, you know, why'd you do that? Do what? You know, threw the oil on the ground. What oil? There was no oil. You know, I didn't see any oil. You saw oil? I didn't see. Like this. So is that even with that rasa there, he wouldn't deal. So the externals stay in place. Like that. Principles are always there. The principles are not broken. Just like someone will say, Prabhupada allowed, they'll say he changed things, right? He allowed women to live in the temples. Then two things are there. One, temple, in India, any major temple, women live in the temples because the Brahmins who worship the Devi live in those temples. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur established mutts. Mutts means only brahmacharis and sannyasis. There's no grihasthas live in a mutt. They can come and do service and all this, but they can't live there. So Bhaktisiddhanta established mutts. Prabhupada just established temples. He didn't call them mutts, he called them temples. So he didn't deviate there from the principle. Second thing is the why he did that, or you know, I say an aspect of doing that, is women must be protected. So in the Western society as it was then, you didn't have communities. There is no question of protection outside the temple. So it's natural that they would need to live in. But as the devotees mature and all that and understand how to take care of themselves and could be nice grihasthas and all that, then you can establish a community. Then that aspect is not so important. Maybe for training in that, but it's not. So there's no principle being broken here. So when devotees many times, I hear them say, well, Prabhupada, Bhakti, they changed everything. They didn't change anything. Because the principles are there. That's why they're acharya. Acharya never changes principles. Krishna never changes them. So why would the acharyas? They just know what is the actual purpose and meaning of them. So then we see it goes on very nicely. Does that make some sense, Mahi? Like that. Is the position they're at is so far beyond all the wrangling of these different things, is that what they see and understand. That's why we're going, that's why the exercise of going through Manu Samhita. Because many times devotees will say the Vedic culture has nothing to do with now. And, you know, Vedic culture, you know, Prabhupada, we don't accept all this, you know. Though Prabhupada always says Vedic culture, right? He always uses the word Vedic culture, you know, like that. Because Prabhupada means is that the Vedic culture, the purpose of the Vedic culture is to go back to Godhead. But it did have allowances for those who are not devotees, non-devotees, so that they could at least follow the culture, that one day they might be able to inject Krishna into it, right? Because if I already respect gurus, you know, respect guests, respect sages, you know, worship some form of deities, you know, and, you know, and do all this thing, you know, go with all the 16 items and all that, and bow down, all that. The only problem with all that is that Krishna is not the object of all that. You know, I make Durga or Shiva or Brahman or something like that. So all I have to do is change that point, one point, and the whole thing becomes perfect. You know? While if we change, so then very quickly it moves. Right? Very quickly it moves. So the whole thing is the culture then is important. But that culture without Krishna doesn't have great meaning. because it'll keep you in the material world. It's like being bound by a gold chain instead of an iron one, you know, by following non-Vedic cultures. But the principle where were we on? Yeah. So then Krishna has established these. He himself comes to do it. He has no duties to do, but he follows it. So that's what he does. He comes here to establish Dharma, to preach. And he has no duties, but he does them anyway. So that means if we want to attain Krishna's, you know, the position in which we can associate with Krishna, then naturally we would follow that same, consideration. That the devotee has no duties to perform, but he does them for the example for others. And he does it to establish the religious principles. So the topmost religious principle is the chanting of the holy name, the Bhagavad Dharma. Then, supporting that, he establishes the Pancharatra. And in supporting that, he establishes the Vedic culture. And we see Prabhupada did all three of those. Lord Chaitanya, Ramanuja, Madhva, they all did this. So this is what's going on. There's all these things that are there. So we're studying this so that we understand that the conclusions and what the book recommends, the Manasamhita recommends, all of these points are all in Prabhupada's books. There's nothing that's been left out. Like, it gives a whole thing about, you know, you eat this bird, don't eat this bird, you know, and it all has to be offered in sacrifice. So the principle is whatever you eat has to be offered in sacrifice. That is maintained. Then at the end of the whole section it says, well, if you really want to get some benefit, then you don't eat any animals at all. And don't perform those sacrifices which kill any animals. So Prabhupada's already given that. So because you've already taken that, you don't have to get into all the, you know, 20 different verses to describe, well, you can not use sparrows, but you can use this bird, but not that bird, and then this animal, and porcupines are okay, but not, you know, this. And we don't have to get into that, you know, because we're already taking the conclusion, which is not to either sacrifice these animals or eat these animals. So that conclusion has already been given in Prabhupada's books, you know. We go through all these things, and we've already come across now three verses that say don't eat mushrooms. And Prabhupada already said that. Like that. So these things are already there. So point is that Prabhupada's already established the Vedic culture for us. What Prabhupada says is the Vedic culture, that is the Vedic culture. The Vedic culture, Vedic culture is so bright it includes down to the lowest of low, up to the Paramahamsas. So the real Vedic culture is that which elevates you to the platform of being Paramahamsa. Right? The Vedic culture, by following it, will get you situated on goodness. And then by the practice of sadhana bhakti and the chanting of the holy name, that will elevate one to pure goodness. Right? But it's very hard to go from ignorance to pure goodness. Right? It's natural that the conditioned soul will just go through all those stages. Right? Isn't it? Someone may say, well, you know, we just chant Hare Krishna, but then why is it then that we hear statements like, oh, everybody's going to get married? You know, why don't the brahmacharis get honest? You know, how can we follow all the four regs? You know, all these different things that are said. This is because we're accepting the principles. No one goes from ignorance to pure goodness in one shot. They have to elevate themselves. So the Vedic culture is how you're going to get from ignorance to goodness. Otherwise, then someone should come up with some other way. Right? I don't think the Christians have a system. I don't think the Jews have a system. I don't think the Muslims have a system. Right? So unless someone was a Buddhist or a Jain before they joined, you know, I mean in practicing, which has a little bit of an idea of getting, but it's through demoniac means. Because non-Vedic, it still has demoniac elements to it. And modern day Buddhism is not pure Buddhism. Pure Buddhism is no house, no nothing. You just wander. So all this where they have their temples and they do all those rituals, that's not actually Buddhism. Buddhism was destroyed during Buddha's lifetime. The real Buddhism was only followed by Buddha and his first followers. But by the end of Buddha's life, already his followers had been deviated. Because he wasn't trying to establish some eternal principles. He was just trying to get them to stop killing animals and all that. And now we see Buddhism has fallen right back into that. I think only the Sri Lankan Buddhists don't eat meat. You know? I think they're it. You know? The Tibetan Buddhists eat anything. Thailand Buddhists eat anything. You know? Because it's all Brahman, you know. So why we should discriminate? You know? Funny thing, if you put a piece of wood into their bowl, they won't eat it. Even though it's all Brahman, but whatever. So it wasn't for that. So then what is the alternative? How one's going to get oneself to goodness? If one's going to say, well, by chanting Hare Krishna, then the emphasis should be on chanting Hare Krishna. Then why do we have the question of so much emphasis on other aspects now? Social development, but not varnashram. So what are the rules of social development that's going to establish us in goodness? Unless that social development is done through varnashram. Dharma creates artha. Artha you can't get on its own. It's not possible. Because Krishna supplies the rewards. So unless you follow a system, how are you going to get it? You may say, well, the karmis are getting money. But why are they getting money? Because in the past, they have performed dharma. And now they're getting the fruit. That's all. But they perform dharma in a non-devotional way. In an atheistic way. Therefore, they were born next life in the West. And they were rich. Right? There's no question, you can't get anything without going through dharma. There's no question of it. One has to, and if one can't understand it, that's a lack of faith. Because all there is that works in this material world is following Krishna's system. Krishna says there's only one path. Ye yatamam papadyante tamstadaiva bhajamiham. Mamavart manuvarte. Oh no. Yeah, there's only one path, and it's Krishna's path. Thus, there is not another path. There absolutely is not another path. So that the person sitting in New York on the 87th floor on the upper west side is because previous lifetime he's followed the Vedic culture, and he's reaping the rewards now. But because he wasn't so theistic, therefore he's born in the West rather than in India. That's explained in the 11th canto. So because if they had just been sinful, then from India they would have just gone to hell. But because they had performed pious activity, but not, they weren't theistic, or their faith was very minimal, therefore then they still take human birth. But not in Aryadesh. They take in the outside for the Mlechas and Yavans. Then from there, then they can go down. Like that. But otherwise, then somebody should come up with a system. And if they come up with a system, then we have to compare their system to God's system. Because Krishna says, Dharmantu Sakshat Bhagavat Pranitam. Dharma comes from God. So then comes a problem. How are we going to make up our own system? So all we're left with is Krishna's system. So now in Krishna's system, what is good for getting back to Godhead, Prabhupada, is taken out of the Manasamhita. You know, we've seen direct quotes. So many times we're going through, it's like exactly as it says in the verse, that's how Prabhupada's given it to us. So then, he's already taken out the Dharma and given it to us. And so these are the aspects of Vaishnava Dharma. Because they're for Krishna, they're Sad Dharma. Right? So this is the meaning of this. Therefore, we're Sanatan Dharmis. We're not Hindus. Hindus means they just follow the whole thing for demigods, this, that, and for piety. No, we follow Sanatan Dharma, which means we follow Dharma that's meant for going back to Godhead. So the essence of that is the chanting of the holy name. So we chant, but because we're conditioned, we follow these other aspects to help us clear us of that conditioning. Otherwise, how are we going to do? Right? How are you gonna? You got to pick your nose. How are you gonna do that for Krishna? Because you're supposed to be remembering Krishna 24 hours a day. So if you can't remember him personally or by chanting, you have to remember in some way. So we just read before, what is impure? You touch any of these, you need to wash your hands. So after washing my hands, after picking my nose, is accepting Krishna's rule of Dharma. And I'm doing it. Therefore, I'm engaging my body in connection with Krishna. Right? So, you know, what one eats, what one doesn't eat, then how is he going to do? He has to eat. He's conditioned. If he's not conditioned, he can give up eating. The Goswamis, you know, Raghunath Das every other day would eat a little bit of buttermilk, this much. It's not enough to maintain. That's all. So one's not on that platform, one has to eat. How is going to engage on Krishna's service? Just eating prasad? That's the start. That's the essential point. But also like washing the hands before they eat, washing them afterwards. You know, otherwise one cannot wash and just eat with the left hand and then, you know, and roll around it and not bother to wash afterwards. One will be purified, you know. I mean, in Regent Park, then Prabhupada went down, they fed prasad to the ducks. Prabhupada said next life they'll take human birth. So the devotee could not do that and just eat with the hand and not wash himself, all that. Yes, next life he'll get human birth. Because this birth is not human. But he's doing service. The duck has done service, devotional service. Therefore, it's taken human birth. So good birth is only due to devotional service. Someone's born in a rich family only because he's done devotional service. That's mentioned in the sixth canto in relationship to Ajamiya. All the people born in aristocratic families, they've done devotional service. The power of devotional service is not understood. We think we're just a small group of little, you know, wild-eyed, you know, Hare Krishnas, you know. The men all wear their mother's bed sheets and all the ladies are, you know, gift-wrapped. And, you know, and just we're a bunch of weird little small bunch, you know. There's 5 billion other people that we somehow know that have to impress. But actually, all the people on the planet who are born in aristocratic families, wealthy, have influence, nobility, only because they've done some service in previous lives. That's mentioned in the purport in the sixth canto. Because Krishna says, you do a little bit of service, but not so much that your faith is very strong, you become deviated very quickly. Then you go to the heavenly planets. After the heavenly planets, you're born in aristocratic families. So they've done something. They saw Ratha out to go by. You know, they heard the Hare Krishna chanting. You know, they took a little something, but their faith wasn't much. They didn't take up the process. They became deviated. You know, they heard, they saw the wrath. That moment, they're doing devotional service. But then they gave it up. Right? All the bugs and everything that are there, and the insects and the germs and all that, that are hearing there when the kirtan's going on. You know? And they're all born in these families. Those ducks, Prabhupada said human birth. He didn't say born in the family of, you know, pure devotees. No. That is for someone who has been doing for some time devotional service and then given it up. Those are the children that are born in the movement. But we must remember they gave it up. Right? Or they didn't, or even if they didn't perfect. Therefore, our children have problems. They have anarthas. That's why we see Hare Krishna kids are also wild. So depending upon what was their degree of advancement, that's where they're going to start with now. You know? They didn't go back to Godhead because they had attachment, you know, to the boys or the girls, or they had attachment to drugs, or they had attachment to not following sadhana, or they had attachment to criticizing others. Right? Do any of these sound familiar for amongst our kids? Yes or no? You don't find many other attachments. Just basic, fundamental. What you see, you look around at the adults now that have a little bit of, you know, they're doing okay, but not so okay. What are their difficulties? You just make a list of that. And then you take that list and you compare it to the children and see if it has some similarities. And if it is, then you know why. Because these devotees in the next life take birth in as children of the devotees. And they're all going to have the same problem. It's not a magic wand. You know, like they ask, are we going too far? Yeah, because I mean, sometimes it's, I mean, how do you say? This can be spoken in a small audience. You might have some people freaking out. But this is reality, the absolute reality. There's a devotee who can't eat anything. In his next life, he'll be born in a family where they eat anything. Devotee who's attached to drugs, his next life, he's still going to be attached to drugs. Devotional service carries on from where you left off. You won't lose any realization, but your material attachments go with you. The subtle body takes your material attachments. That's made of material attachments. That's what it is. Subtle body is your material attachments. Your material identity. Your material intelligence. That goes with you to the next life. Therefore, one has to be very serious in this life to dissolve that. And how are you going to dissolve that? By engaging in Krishna's service. By restricting it. By restriction, you destroy. Right? If some devotee was attached to smoking cigarettes, the Prabhupada found out about it. So Prabhupada said, okay, you smoke 2 cigarettes a day. 2. You pick a time. And at that time only, you smoke that cigarette. And then by doing that, then you reduce it down. Okay, I can smoke, but I can only smoke 2. And then after a while, the mind sees that you lose the attraction. Because as soon as something's legal and it's restricted, then it becomes boring. And then it becomes just ordinary, and then you can drop it. See, something is hard to give up as long as there's some mystique about it, something special about it. Right? Something special. As soon as that mystique is gone, that's what regulation does. That's why Parakya Ras is so exciting, but Swakya Ras is downright boring. Right? Because it's regulated. So as soon as you regulate it, then you can break your attachment for it. Therefore, you regulate your eating, regulate your sleeping, regulate your mating, regulate the defending, and then you can break attachment for all of it. And that's what human life is meant for. So how are you going to do that without restriction? You don't restrict, then a few days ago it said it's like pouring ghee on the fire, it just gets bigger. Just gets bigger. Then when you say, oh, cool, we'll just flood it. You know, because Prabhupada says also, you just put too much ghee and it goes out. But then one must remember is all those pictures are in the mind and they're all going to come back to you. And you have to each one say no to. So it's better to follow the path of restriction. Right? They do so many things and then all those pictures are in their mind. All the pictures are there, and you have to give those up. So the less pictures, less trouble. The more pictures, the more anxiety. Is that one day you have to go through and give it all up. Right? We got into this material world because of our choice. We made the choice to come here. So we're going to get out of here by making the choice to give it up. Right? Like that. It's not a magic wand. So many times devotees are saying it's just a magic wand. I'll just chant Hare Krishna, and then my little, you know, fairy god person will come along and touch me on the head with their magic wand, and poof, I'll be a pure and alloyed devotee. You know, and being a pure and alloyed devotee, all material facilities will be wonderful, and, you know, all respect and interactions will be so wonderful and nice and kind and sweet and all this, and, you know, the butterflies will be flying, the rainbows will be out, and the sun will be shining, and the wind will be blowing, and, you know, it'll be just, you know, it'll just be, well, isn't that what we want, right? But no, that's called Nandankana, you know? That's next to the Trikuti Mountain up on Indra's place. That's not here. It's not here. Because we're not interested in enjoyment, we're interested in remembering Krishna. We're interested in remembering Krishna. So for that, for us, that's enjoyment. Right? For us, that's enjoyment. Yes. 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 Yeah, means yukta vairagya means you're using the thing. The problem what comes is that the thing is used in Krishna service, not the culture. You'll generally see the problem comes is someone uses the thing in Krishna's culture, Krishna's service, but then they accept the culture that goes along with it. That's what takes them out. Because they use the non-devotional culture that the karmis use with that item. No, we have our own culture. We use it according to our own culture. And this culture can be used anywhere. You know? It means we can be in India and not eat onions and garlic. We can be in America and not eat onions and garlic. Right? You know, we can clean our backside after passing stool in India. We can also do it in America. You know? Whatever is mentioned, it can be done anywhere. Maybe a few situations in which, you know, you can't wash your feet and stuff after going to the bathroom when you're traveling in a car and you go into, you know, a gas station or something. But as soon as you get back to the temple or your house, then you're going to take a bath, put on clean clothes and all that, and then you're going to wash your feet and hands and mouth when you go to the bathroom. So those are emergency situations. That's not standard. So we have to be very, very careful as we have our culture and Prabhupada's given us. This is the difficulty. Devotees, you have the senses, you have the emotions, which is the platform of culture, and you have the spiritual. So devotees have taken the philosophy, thrown out their old philosophies generally, and accepted Krishna consciousness. They've thrown out their ideas how to deal with the senses and accepted the Krishna consciousness. They've thrown out their previous religions, but they haven't accepted the dharma of Krishna consciousness. Therefore, there's so much emotional instability and frustration because they haven't understood how to engage the emotional platform, the mental platform, and the platform of desires in Krishna's service. But it's here. We just said it. You know? We've just gone through it. So if one doesn't do those things, there's not going to be satisfaction. Can't be satisfaction. You know, if the men don't respect the women, they can't be satisfied. They don't respect the cows, don't respect the Brahmins, don't protect the children, don't protect the old people. It can't be satisfaction. Why? Because that mood of protection is the meaning of being in a superior position. Superior position means I protect those who are under me. That's what it means. And it specifically means that I have to save them from death. Right? Don't become a mother, a father, a guru, a king, or presiding demigod if you can't save the dependents from death. So don't become a temple president. Don't become a mother and father. Don't become a teacher in the gurukul or a guru unless you know the system how to make somebody Krishna conscious. Right? Getting married only because we're lusty is not standard. That's not a grihasta. That's a grihamedi. Why? Because the center of the relationship is lust. That's not... Grihasta means Krishna is the center. So we see, I have lust. So therefore, how to get rid of that? I have to follow Krishna's system for getting rid of that, which is the grihasta ashram. And Krishna gives me all these different rules I follow. Then all these different things of emotional needs will be engaged in Krishna's service. And I do all those because it's Krishna's rules. And as a devotee, I'm to think of Krishna all the time. I have my sadhana and I have my chanting. So from all these three platforms, I have an opportunity to think of Krishna. Either directly on the spontaneous platform, or through the platform of vidhi, or through the platform of just the rules and regulations that just deal with my social dealings, how I deal with my wife. Do I come in and it's been a bad day and yell and scream and slap her around the house? Or do I come in and, you know, properly and sit down and, you know, find out how she was doing in the day and this and that. And then after she's spoken, then she'll naturally ask, how was your day? And then you say it was a little difficult and this and that. And then you say all these things, and then the relationship is there. So that's the options. We either follow Krishna's, or there is no option. The West has nothing to offer. Anything that does work has come from the Vedas anyway. Be nice, be compassionate, but that's what all the verses say in here. But what is being nice? What is being compassionate? That is being able to save from death. Right? So that's real mother and father. That's real teacher. That's real guru. That's real manager. Don't become a temple president if you don't know how, if your interest is not how to help these devotees go back to Godhead. If it's simply how to make a lot of money and be top on the chart and make a big temple and like that, that's not actually a temple president. That may be a temple manager, but the manager is controlled by the temple president. Right? Leaders hire managers. But leaders protect people and bring them up in Krishna consciousness. So if we look at it, it's because devotees haven't followed the Vedic culture, therefore there's a problem. On the social platform. They haven't followed. They may say they did, but where? Where have they followed? You know? So much is there. Okay, we dress, but even that nowadays, right? Like it says, women, if their hair is long, it's braided, right? At this festival, how many ponytails do we see? And what is the fashion now in the West? Ponytails. So our women are just following Western fashion. So what does that got to do? How are they engaging themselves in Krishna service? They're just thinking, this looks good to the karmis. We got to look good to the karmis. It's PR, it's this, it's that. But then in Mayapur, what's the PR? Women in India braid their hair, put it up in buns or something. What is the meaning? So it's not just, it's not PR. It's material desire. It's lack of training. And then we say, you know, we tried following Vedic culture. We didn't. We may have tried, but unless you know what you're following. So we have to be a little bit careful. Then, we'll see. It works very nicely. Prabhupada has given us so many things. How brahmachari should behave. How the men behave. How the women behave. How the leaders behave. How the sannyasis behave. How a devotee behaves. You know, all these things are given. So if we follow those, then we get very nice results. But the very nice result means we become Krishna conscious. Very nice result doesn't mean we become rich and famous. We may not. Right? We can only become rich and famous when we are detached. Or we want it so much that we've been caught by Maya, then she makes us rich and famous. But if we want Krishna to make us rich and famous, then we have to be detached from it where we don't care about our rich and famous. Right? Dhruva Maharaj wanted to be the biggest. He wanted a kingdom bigger than, you know, his father's, or was it grandfather's, like that. So his father happened to be at the time the king of the universe, you know, so he wanted bigger than that. So there isn't anything bigger than that. So then Krishna made him the king of his transcendental planet, which is bigger than the universe, which is greater than the universe. But when he offered it to him at that time, he didn't want it anymore. Because he didn't want it, therefore if he gives that, it won't disturb his service. Whether he's sitting there in the forest with nothing, or he's sitting there as the emperor of Vaikuntha, there will be no difference in his service. Sudama Brahmana, because there won't be any change in his service, therefore he had more wealth than Indra. Raghunath Das, he had his family was so rich. Two million gold coins a year was their profit, right? You know, I mean, And in those days, you know, it says that, you know, they would give, he would, Advaitacharya, he would give garlands and kodi, right? He says conch shells. So conch shells, little dinky things. So conch shells, 11 of those is one paisa. Right? So those days, you used to go to the market with conch shells. You know, one paisa was too much. You couldn't, you know, a family couldn't eat one paisa. When Prabhupada was a child, you know, he said one paisa would buy more sabji than a family could eat. He says more than one man could carry. Right? And in Calcutta, if you've seen them carry, they can carry quite a few kilos. Huh? He said 25? At that time. Well, I thought it was one paisa. So 25 paisa. So that was then. So you take that back 500 years, then it would have been much less. I mean, they were going to kill Sanatana Goswami for what, 8 gold coins? Mm. Right? I mean, that was big bucks. Mm. So you can imagine 2 million gold coins. I mean, there's no one on the planet that wealthy. There's no one on the planet has that much wealth. An individual. No one has that much gold. Right? They have that. They may have it in land. Right? They may have it in stocks. They may have it in, you know, paper. But in actual, real substance, who has it? So how much they have? His wife was more beautiful than Indrani. But it didn't bother him. He just wanted to go out and... So he had all that. So then, didn't matter to him. So when one's on that platform, then Krishna can give. Because otherwise it gives prematurely. Krishna wants to give, just like the father wants to give everything to the child. But if he gives it too early, he'll waste it. It'll make him bad, it won't make him good. Therefore Krishna may not give. And then devotees wonder, why? Why doesn't Krishna give? Why so much trouble? Why so much anxiety? I joined Krishna consciousness to get rid of all this. But the process for getting rid of it, you know, is to become Krishna conscious. Then it works very nicely. Oh, I see. Charana. That's what it was?
And still there was change.
And still there was change from Charana. Okay. Yeah, someone told me one paisa, but it was Charana. Means the rupee used to be 16 annas. So 4 annas is 25 paisa. That's why it's called Naya paisa, because there's 100 paisa in a rupee rather than 16. Atana would be 50 paisa. Barawana would be 75 paisa. When I came to India, you could still talk like that. I don't know now. When I came, you'd still talking in annas.
When we first came, we used to pay the labor, and we used to have two pice DD money.
Two paisa per day for DD. Yeah. Unwritten rule, yeah. Oh yeah, and also beggars got 2 paisa, and that was like a nice amount of money.
Now you give them a rupee and they grow at
you. Yeah, they want a rupee or, yeah, rupee, and less than that they don't even. Any other? What time is it? 7:30. Oh, sorry about that. Anything else? Or stuff here? Okay. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jai Shri Prabhupada ki jai. Adultery, theft. for speeches that ought not to be uttered. That and every fine shall be double. You're getting everything. Wages, non-payment of wages. Debts. Debts. I mean, all this gets into a lot of stuff. The king. This is all the king's studies. If I gave class tomorrow, yes, tell him I already gave. It's fine. Oh, give. Okay. Yes. Then it becomes very easy. But if one doesn't accept it, one can't do it. So if one can't accept Krishna's culture, there's no question that one can follow any other culture. You know? I mean, you go to any of our big communities in the world, they don't follow. They don't want to follow. But they're not able to put together even on the Western, you know, ideal emotional platform. You know? Like that. You see a few that can, you know, maybe the Mormons or others. But devotees will quote them and look to them even rather than the Vedic culture. But well, there's one thing that they have that the devotees aren't willing to accept. And that's accepting one set of values. Mm. You know? Like here, it's very hard to put together a community because there's not the same values. You know? Like I was telling some grihasthas, you know, says, you know, I was asking, why is it that when children are in their house, that they tell their own children to get rid of their friends because it's time for lunch? And it says, you know, what has this got to do with reality? Parental ras means parental ras. Here's children. Mm. You know, children must be fed. They're in your house, you feed them. Tomorrow they're in someone else's house, they'll feed them. You know? And then they all talk about community and we'll have meetings and all this and that. You know? They don't have no idea of what parental ras is. You know? If someone else is nice to their kid, they freak out. At the same time as if the kid gets in trouble, and then they say, no one says anything, no one cares. But if you do say anything, you know, you'll have the father out after your backside. So I mean, it's just, there's no idea. It's they've just taken the, you know, whatever little bit of the West that they knew. But, then, you know, the culture in the West, I think, disappeared in the 30s in America. You know, in Europe, you know, a little later. Maybe in the 60s, 70s.
They speak like that, the ponytails.
Huh?
But in the West, it's like normal. They don't know any better. Yeah, they don't know. So they come here, they don't know. They have to change.
That I accept. I have no problem with that. Mm-hmm. But then they shouldn't be proud of what they have. Yeah. See, it's one thing is if somebody doesn't know and they're just doing the best they can, that's honest. Mm-hmm. But as soon as they find out there is something higher, then they should be willing to learn it. But then when they don't want to learn that, you know, we are who we are, we should be accepted for what we are, fine, but then set up with your own community somewhere else. Because the Vedas say that also. You don't want to follow this, fine. No one's going to complain. Go to the forest.
But always the Yukta Vairagya gets used as an excuse.
But what is it? But how is it being used? Yukta Vairagya means you're using it in preaching. Yeah. How is Kellogg's cornflakes Yukta Vairagya? How is it aiding the preaching mission?
Convenience
for what? You saved the time to do what? Are they chanting 16-4 rounds because now they just eat a box of Kellogg's cornflakes? You know, if that's okay, then I won't complain. But they're not. But what is there so much to do? Why is there so much to do? Because there's so much anxiety. What are they doing? When they're all sitting together, what are they talking about? The problems. They're not talking about nice things or how to make things work or this or that. You see, when Kunti and Subhadra came together with Draupadi, I'm not sure where it was, where they all met. It was at Kurukshetra, where they met. And they sat down and were asking her, how does she perform her duties? Right? Draupadi means Kunti and Subhadra, they had to be able to live with one man and successfully perform their duties. So they were impressed. Draupadi could live with five. So they were asking her, what does she do? What is the secret? So there's no discussion, there's no exchange on the emotional platform. You know? We're sorry to say, but the body becoming disturbed with hormones and other, what do we call, emotions, the animal emotions, that's not the emotional platform. The emotional platform is when one person experiences with another the same feeling based on a common point. Like the mother and father experience a parental ras together when the child is the center of attention. Like that. And they're both working for that child. Then they experience it. But when they're fighting over this and that, and who's superior, they think they're experiencing emotions, but those are lower emotions. Those are not, that's the platform of Dharma. Therefore, they're not satisfied. Why are the marriages falling apart? Because they're not experiencing any emotion. Otherwise, they won't fall apart. Why would they fall apart? If you're getting pleasure someplace, you don't reject it. If you're not getting pleasure someplace or satisfaction, you reject that. The thing is very simple and straightforward. But one has to accept it. Then one can learn how to work it. Just like if I want to learn a computer, but you know, I'll do it my own way and all this and that. I can go on like that for years and never figure out. If I haven't learned anything. But if I just accept, okay, I have to accept there's a way that this computer works. And if I just go to someone who knows, they'll tell me, and very quickly I'll be able to use it. So the whole point is Grihastha Ashram is a tool. It has to be used for a purpose. Otherwise, what is the purpose? You know, what is the purpose of our community here? Other than, it's very expensive to live in the West. It's much cheaper to live in India. How much money? 1 month, maximum 2 months of money in the West will get you a whole year in India. Right? Okay, you're worried that, you know, some, you know, low class, you know, what do they call it? What are they called now? You know. What's the pigmentation in the skin?
Melanin.
You know, you're worried that some melanin-enhanced guy will come along and rape your daughter. So then we come over to India. You know? Like that. Is that politically correct enough? So, you know, and things like that. But there's no question that many of these devotees thought, let us go to Mayapur and learn what is our heritage. What is our actual Gaudiya culture? Yeah? Most devotees, the only thing they know about Indians are the maid that they hire, the taxi drivers that they hire, the guys outside the front gate that they go out and buy their, you know, soda pops from, and the beggars outside the airport. And of course, then the guys in the airport who take their tickets. To them, that's all they know of India. So when you start talking about all these elevated things of Vedic culture, they go, where is it? I don't see it. I've been living in India for 5 years. I haven't seen it. They have not seen India. Because they didn't come here to learn. Otherwise, you can see it every day. You know? You can see it every day. We have thousands of people see here. You can see the culture happening every day. You can see the culture happening in its pure form. You can see the culture happening in its degraded form, or the loss of the culture. You can see what you want to see. Mayapur is Chintamani. What you want, you get. You want to hear politics, you can hear the latest thing that's just happened out of America, here, there, anywhere. You don't want to hear any of that, you can move in circles, you never hear that stuff. You hear whatever you want. You live whatever you want, you get whatever you want. Yeah, but especially in Mayapur. Because things move much more rapidly. One has to be very, very careful. But the point is, what is it? Okay, the guy's married, they're living here, they have the kids. What's the goal of it? I mean, why have the children? Right? What was the purpose? You know, why have a house? why anything? But human life starts with why. Are they asking? Why have the kids? What is going on? Right? Is that all their own values are tested with the child? You know, you can walk over there and see what are the parents' values by looking at the kid. When the kids are wearing the latest Western stuff with earrings, then you know what the parents' values are. Unless, of course, the kid absolutely is older and just doesn't listen to parents, that's another thing. But if they're young enough where they're still in the control of the parents, then you know what their values are. Because you give the best to your children. No one gives the worst to their children, they give their best. So you see the values. So it's you know, that then the question comes, why? Community means common values. You just look it up in the dictionary, what it means. So common values means you have to come to a common value. I ask one parent why they don't, you know, let the kids, you know, either have kids eat in their house or let their kids eat in other houses. And they said, well, frankly, it's because the standards are so low in some people's houses. I don't want my kids eating there. You know, they eat karmi grains, they eat all kinds of stuff and this and that, and they don't care. And there's, so therefore, and then, so how will there be community? They can't. You know? There can't be. That's the difficulty. It comes from desire. If they want to change it, only then you can change it. They don't want to change it, you can't change it. Yeah, but the ones who claim to be the leaders of the community are the ones who will never come and discuss these things. You know? You never see them. When there's a discussion like this, of Varnashram and all that, you'll never see any of the community who claim to be the community leaders there. I've never seen. You start something on a social issue, then you'll see them there. But issues have never solved anybody's problems. It's not that the modern thing is some perfection of development over thousands of years of, you know, Western culture and all that. No. You know, the Romans had the same problems as today. And that their culture went down, you know, from drugs. You know, drugs and, you know, the family units just breaking up and all that. And that's how they went down. And they were strong when they were austere. They maintained common values. And when it diversified because of, you know, becoming wealthy and all that, it fell apart. They talk social development. I don't know. I mean, Pankajungri's gone. But I mean, what Grihasthas had, you know, when Prabhupada was here in Mayapur, you know, I would say the Brahmacharinis lived better than the Grihasthas lived then. Right? So the economic development is so great. I mean, amazingly great. I mean, we had fat rice, thin dal, and stick sabji cooked in mustard oil with chilies. You know, you had a little room that had no furniture in it, maybe a couple of mats and some books on, you know, a couple of bricks on a couple of boards, and that was your shelves. You know? That was it. So what they have now, I mean, it's amazing, you know. Have, you know, oh, they had a fan. You know, they would have had a fan, generally. Like that. But, you know, they have their hot water heaters, and they have the ovens, and they have all their, you know, different mixies and all kinds of gizmos in the kitchen, and all their sound equipments and furnitures and this and that, and nice big apartments, you know, like this. They have so many things they have. Yeah. Facility for the kids, playgrounds, this and that. And then they're saying, you know, we've been screwed. There's no social development. And it's kind of like, oh, wait a minute. You know, when Prabhupada first started the grihasthas, they'd take one room and hang up some blankets and divide it into three, and three grihastha couples would stay there. You know, Or some temples, and you know, the men lived in one place, the women lived in the other. And they can say, well, yeah, well, that was the problem. That's why it's all screwed up. Now they're all living together, and they're all breaking up in marriages and getting married for the third time when they're 50 years old. So, I mean, how is it improved? These arguments don't hold water. It's just due to a lack of culture, that's all. Just basic lack of culture. We're proud of being Westerners. We're proud of it. We don't want to change. We think, because we're Westerners, we know everything. Just by being born a Westerner, you're automatically superior. You know, just by becoming a Grihastha, you automatically know about children. How is that? Right? One knows how to make them. I'm always impressed with that, you know? Like that, is that, it always amazes me that one. Still can't figure that one out. So it's, they're able to have the children, but then they only know as much as the animal. And the animal works by instinct. The super soul tells them what to do. Instinct. You know? So since we don't listen to super soul, that means we have to learn from outside Krishna's rules. And since we don't follow that, then, oh, at best, okay, we buy a book on Dr. Spock or something like that. Somehow or another, he's okay, but, you know, the Vedas aren't. So it becomes very hard to accept. And all the thing is, it's all the sannyasis and all that, they're the ones that have screwed everything up. But all the temple presidents previously were all grihasthas. They still are. You look around the movement. How many are sannyasis or brahmacharis? I mean, when I was a devotee, except for in India, everywhere in the world it was all grihasthas. It was just understood. You get become a temple president, then you have to deal with, you know, all the families and all that. You had to be a grihastha. But somehow or another, it's been very cleanly just avoided, and it's all been blamed on the sannyasis. You know? And those big, powerful sannyasis, they've been gone for years. You know? They came up at a short time in the 80s and disappeared in the 80s. But somehow or another, it's very easy to blame everything on them. Right? It's been how many years now since they've all been gone? 12 years. Or, right? 12, 13 years. Still, it's all their fault. You know? Give $100 today to someone who's a businessman, and he'll set up a business. It doesn't take him 12 years. Right? Kshatriya, he'll organize it. Brahmins don't need it, unless they're materialistic. You know, they follow the Asuric culture. You know? Asuric Brahmins. So that leaves one class of man who in 12 years hasn't gotten it together and has and blames everybody else because they're dependent upon everybody else. And this, they won't accept. Never accept. Can't accept. Because the ego is too big. Right? Why do Shudras follow the other three? Because they're independent. Vaishyas will make their own money, Kshatriyas will get it together, Brahmins couldn't care less. But the Shudra, someone has to give it to them. And what's that being said? No one's given it to us. Right? That's exactly what's said. No one's given us the opportunity. I don't know, there's millionaires in Alachua. So the whole thing is, it's all you know, whatever, modern terminology, smokescreen, right? It's all a smokescreen. They don't want to accept their own inability. And just go on. This one has this idea, that one has that idea. You know, so Prabhupada says, why they can't come to a conclusion? Philosophy without culture is mental speculation. Therefore, there's so much speculation. Because they won't accept the culture. The culture is the Varnashram. You accept the Varnashram, and you accept the philosophy, it's perfect. Then you have social development. So, it's not practical from the West. Why is it that the Westerner in the West puts food in his mouth, chews it up, swallows it, and it comes out the Western gate? And when they're in India, it works exactly the same way. They eat, they sleep, they mate, they defend, and it all works. Right? It's not because they're Westerners, they take the food and stuff it into their ear and nourish themselves. It's because they're uninformed. These are statements of uninformed people. But you can only train somebody when there's a desire to learn and there's submissive inquiry. You bring devotees together to discuss these points. It's challenging questions, heavy challenging questions. If you hit one of the buzzwords, boy, that's it. Heavy, heavy. You can't even say what Prabhupada says. The faith is so low. So first is faith, then sadhu sangha. Therefore, they can't put a community together. Because there's not enough faith to create sadhu sangha. Then there's bhajana kriya. Then there's serious sadhana and everything. I don't see a lot of heavy sadhana going on over there. You know? Then you get to anartha nivritti, which gets rid of the anarthas that are, you know, the God's gift to the malechas. You know, the birthright of the malechas to be full of anarthas. Indians are also full of anarthas. They're generally the subtle ones. Westerners, the gross ones. Then you get to nishta, fixed in devotional service. But if there's no faith, there's not even faith in what Prabhupada's given. You know, faith in Prabhupada's system, social system, educational system. Devotees will badmouth Prabhupada, blame it on him, say he was wrong. And these are supposedly leaders, or they used to be. They'll say it's this one's fault, that one's fault. Heck, they were the temple presidents, they were the GBCs, they were the sannyasis. I mean, I heard, what is it? I forget how many years ago. You know, maybe 5 years ago, there were 26, I think, ex-temple presidents who were there. These were the ones that screwed people's lives when they were in charge. They're the ones that disenfranchised devotees. But, you know, you don't hear about that. That's what Prabhupada said, that they are worth 10 of our sannyasis. I don't know if he said 10 of our sannyasis, he said 10 sannyasis. So Hotumar has made an interesting point this morning to me, is that when Prabhupada said that our grihasthas are better than sannyasis, he meant better than the Gaudiya Math sannyasis. Yeah. Because they were attached to their rooms and this and that. You know, the Bhagavad Math, the whole thing fell apart because they'd fight over which room they were in. You know, which one gets the sun, the morning sun, and which one's away from the street, the less noise, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. What he called foppery, you know. Like that. Because the grihasthas were detached, and they were engaged, and so they were satisfied. But they drop from that standard, and now they're more dissatisfied. They have much more economic facility than they had before. Still, they're unsatisfied. So that shows it's not because before they did and they gave up. No. If you're going to not be so engaged in devotional, in direct preaching on the Bhagavad, then you better be engaged in the Pancharatra. If you can't be fully engaged in that, you better be engaged in the Varnashram. Because the things below that aren't very inspiring. You know, they took bath once a year when they went into, you know, into the, huh?
when they went down, you know, when they herded all the cattle down south to the slaughterhouses and got paid, and they might take a bath. It didn't come from them. It came from Europe. You know? So that means you had to, then you have to go back to old school Europe. And old school Europe was strict in discipline and culture. They're not very strict. They're not willing to go to that. So what is the alternative? What's the option? New age? You know? And the funny thing, they call it new age. But, you know, when I grew up in the 60s, my grandmother was new age. I mean, I grew up reading UFO magazines, and she took me to spirulina conferences, and she used to, you know, fill me up with carrot juice and all that, you know. And so I find it very amusing, you know, the end of the world, all these different things. So I find it very amusing today that devotees are so absorbed in that. I grew up with my grandmother with that stuff, you know, 30 years ago. And that's old. It started back in the 30s, that stuff. You know? In the 30s, all your 14 times and all these weird alternative new age stuff. But then it was, you know, only a few, you know, crackheads got into it, you know? What to do? You know? Point is one has to be trained in it, learn it. It's not something you can learn overnight. That's the thing, is if you can't just learn it like that, then that's the American thing, the maverick, right? All of the places is the discipline you go through, but the American thing is it's just spontaneous. It just happens, and you become expert. So that element Prabhupada would use in Krishna Sura. He just sent all the yatras of the world are started by Americans. He just send them out. They'll just change this, do this, that, and just do something. But then once you've done that, that element keep. That's great. But then you can also learn the culture. The problem is, you know, the Asians get stuck and just, they don't want anything, you know, this works, they don't want to try anything else because it might not work. Europeans, continental Europeans are the same. Americans, they'll try anything. You know, it's just saying, you know, it's like, I'll try anything once. You know, that's just, they're willing to do that. Other parts of the world are not willing to do that. So that is the element that you use in Krishna's service. They're willing to try anything in preaching. And if it works, they'll go for it. If it doesn't, but that doesn't mean that you don't try to develop our own culture along with it. The drive you keep, that's just expertise of moving the material nature. But you should also learn how to deal, that's the externals, but you also have to learn how to deal with the subtle body. Americans that can deal with the gross body, they have no understanding of the subtle body. You know, other than to notice things in the subtle body than how they can move the gross body. But otherwise, they have to learn the culture. How to deal with the subtle body. The subtle body's freaking out. Their bodies aren't freaking out over there. You know, neither there, nor in Mawilamba, nor in the manor, nor in Alachua. Their bodies aren't freaking out. Their bodies are doing pretty good. You know? So what's freaking out? The subtle body. So to deal with the subtle body requires the training in the subtleties. You have to know what is the mind, how it works. It only accepts and rejects. So they reject the Vedic culture. Then what do you do? That's it. There's not another option now. Because due to ego, they think, I did it. I practice Vedic culture, you know. As a brahmachari, I'd spit on the women, you know. So I practiced, I was a good, you know, I followed it. You know, but somehow or another, the brahmachari is supposed to see all women as mother. That means you're supposed to respect them. That means you deal properly with them, without attachment. Did they do that? No. You know? Okay, Vedic culture. The man's the boss, the woman has to be submissive. Right? But we didn't notice that when we went through this on the man's side. This is how the woman looks at it. The man looks at it for, I must protect my wife. I must be sensitive to her needs. I must take care of what she needs. I must see that she is satisfied. That wasn't taken. Therefore, the system didn't work. The man took the woman's mood. You know? You know, because nowadays it's very rare to find men. You know? Right? So it didn't work. So can they actually say with a clean conscience, I did what Prabhupada said and it didn't work? You know? Leader, you know, has to protect those who are under. That's the meaning of the parental rasa. The teachers didn't protect the children. The parents didn't protect their children. The husbands aren't protecting the wife. The temple leaders aren't protecting the devotees in the temple. You know? The temple devotees aren't protecting the congregation. Right? And then we're going to say Vedic system didn't work. You know, where's the it didn't work because we didn't practice parental rasa. It means all of those persons are responsible to save their dependents from death. So was that the consideration? When the temple president told the devotee to stay out on Sankirtan when they're freaking out because they don't have the nature to do it, and the person blooped, was that protection? Was that Krishna conscious? So who's at fault? The Vedic culture was used for their own means. For their own idea, their own position, their own power. And then when the guy blooped, oh, they weren't sincere. So then, like that. Why did they take him in the temple in the first place? Prabhupada said years ago when he was here, boil the milk. We've made enough devotees. Now let's go for quality. That means starting to train the devotees. Did the temple presidents do it? No, they were very busy just making big, big temples. You know? Three altars. Nowadays, you make a temple, it has to have three altars. Even the temple has no devotees in it. They must make three altars. You know, they got more deities than devotees in the whole temple, let alone pujaris. Why? Oh, we got a big temple. We're doing big preaching. It's an aspect, but if you have no devotees, then it doesn't have any meaning. One has to be, you know? So that's the thing. Why are the children not being, why are they so screwed up? Why are the women so dissatisfied? Why are the cows so not taken care of, you know? Well, old people aren't really taken care of. And there's not very many of them, so they're not yelling and screaming yet. You know? Brahmins, forget protecting Brahmins. You know? First thing is something goes wrong, you know, just, you know. If anything goes wrong in the system of the kids, it's the teacher's fault. It's not the parents' fault. Jagadish Maharaj once did a study, because there was so much complaint coming in about the teachers. And he pointed out all the kids that had, you know, blooped and had big problems because the families they came from were broken families. And the kids from parents where there's two-parent family, they very rarely had any problems. You know, I saw once. He just gave. He gave numbers. He actually, because in those days, you could count everybody. You know? You could count. Because all the kids in the schools are all devotee kids, and, you know, everybody knew everybody. And he would travel around the world, so he just took a list. And he just, one year, he just went, because in his travel, he just went around. What are all your kids? Who's good? Who has difficulties? Who are their parents? And they found out, and he just put it down, and he presented that. Like that. And they may say, well, that was the thing, we had to send our kids away, we had to do this, we had to do that, somehow or another, but... Them it's not a matter of why you know, you're a human being, why didn't you use your consciousness? No, that doesn't count. That no one will bring up, not one person. If you bring it up, boy, you'll see, you know, nuclear emotions. You know, nuclear emotions. But the teachers, oh, then it's Nuremberg. You know, well, we just followed orders. No, but you're an individual. You can make your own decisions. Therefore, it's not social development. It's fascism. And the modern karmis understand this. There's books on it. All this New Age stuff and all these issues and that, they just use the word. They say it's fascism. Because they study fascists and they studied how it works. They're so liberal with the Grihasthas, but the teachers, they get it. So where's the protection of Brahmins? Right? Parents, the leaders, the teachers, nobody knew what they were doing. But who's going to take the rap? Only the teachers. The leaders have already, you know, blooped or gone to Alachua, you know. They're all over there chewing gum, you know. I saw one of them the other day here, you know, walking around chewing his gum, you know. He used to be the big regional secretary in Europe. And he's saying, you know, sannyasis, this one, this one, that. And I'm going, oh, who? Well, wasn't he one of them a few years ago? You know, he did his share. You know, now they're going to rectify. You know? Like that. Parents won't take any rap. Nothing. Zero. Why? Because they know how to biologically produce the children. Therefore, they're expert. Right? Isn't that what the Vedas said? First birth is animal birth. I mean, it's a very important thing. You know? If they hadn't produced the animal, then how will the teacher have the opportunity to turn the animal into a human being? Like that. You know, so everything gets turned upside down. What's dharma is adharma. What's adharma becomes dharma. When you can't tell the difference, this is a mode of passion. Devotees can't tell. Well, we don't know what's right, what's wrong. Right out of the Gita. That's intelligence in the mode of passion. And when he says, what's dharma is adharma, and adharma is adharma. You talk about ashram schools. America wants to close them all. So now, what intelligence is that? According to Gita. It was Prabhupada's desire.
I was criticized
like anything because I put my son in ashram. Yeah. Because they say you don't care. I was just watching today. I was watching a boy about 11 years old, maybe 12, wandering around with a 10-year-old girl. They were alone out on the playing field in the Grihastha community, just walking together and all this. That is all right. That's perfectly normal. As long as a girl never gets pregnant, that's all. Then it's okay. I mean, that's the American standard. Girl doesn't come home pregnant, it's okay. Anything short of that's okay. So, what is the dharma? Why did they become children? What are they doing to save them from death? They're only worried that they get them an education so they won't blame them and they can get a job. So, why have them in the first place? If there's no more training beyond that. Or accept, okay, we don't mind at all. Because the Vedic culture condones. But understand that they're being trained as a Shudra. The training and upbringing is that of a Shudra, not of a Dvija. Dvijas go to Gurukul. They may say, well, none of the Gurukuls are qualified. That may be there. Because one, students are unqualified and parents are unqualified. Right? Are the parents seeing that the best people coming in the Gurukuls? You know? I don't know where any of these people were when I've been trying to do all these schools here. There's not one person in that community that's ever helped organize anything. When they have their own son, then they start to think about, okay, well, and they have a little interest in Gurukul, then they think about, well, maybe we should raise some funds for the Gurukul. You know? Where were them when I had 120 kids? And we had no money to feed them. And we were eating khichdi without turmeric in it. Where were they then? We had no milk, no fruit. Where were they then? You know? Where were they then? But you spend all your time like that to take care and live with 120 madmen. You know? And then afterwards, then when the madmen aren't satisfied that they didn't get PhDs, then they come out looking for you. You know? The vigilante squad is out. So, and they talk about social development, culture, and love and trust. You know? It's not balanced. It's not balanced. You know? I didn't see any of these people then. Only now then they're talking. They have kids themselves. Now they're worried. Then they didn't. Then they didn't care. Didn't care at all. So, I mean, it's... Point is Prabhupada wanted an educational system based on the Vedic principles. Prabhupada wanted that. So now, if we're actually followers of Prabhupada, we've made mistakes, but let's try to correct them. Right? We should try to correct them. You see, the few ashram schools that are left now, the children seem to be quite happy in them. Previously they weren't, but now they like the schools. They like being in the schools. They like being in the ashrams. So that means they've learned something. So why not support that? Why not find out what it was? Has anybody gone around and asked the kids and done a report? What did they like about the Gurukul? What did they feel benefited them? Have you ever seen such a report? No, never. Because it doesn't get the bile moving. It doesn't make life worthwhile. If I'm not into my sadhana or going back to Godhead, I have to have something to keep me busy. So I have to create an issue. You know? I've seen, if a student attacks the teachers, everybody goes, oh, that's okay. But if a student supports the teachers and fights against those who are attacking the teachers, that's considered very bad. I've seen it myself, and you can ask the students. They'll confirm this. They're chastised like anything. But if you speak badly against and use square words and this and that, that's fine. Perfectly all right. So where's the austerity of the tongue? Where's austerity? Austerity's not valued. So that's one of the principles of Brahmacharya. Therefore, no one likes the ashrams. Because they don't have any themselves. There's no respect for authority. Yes, but that we understand. That's okay. I don't mind. I understand that. But they have to understand is that if they're so attached to their child, but what are they attached to? Just the body? Because that's what they've produced. Right? The combination of the mother's and father's secretions has created the body. And due to their own consciousness, they've invited a particular soul to enter that body. So they produced a gross body, but they've invited a subtle body. And that subtle body is then a manifestation of what their consciousness was. So if the kid's wild, then at least one of the parents was in an enjoying mood when they conceived the child. Right? Which is natural in the modern scenario, because nowadays sex is only for enjoyment. So you practice that for many years. So then even you want to have religiously have a child, the habit is not that. So at the moment of conception, the parents are going to be, you know, thinking of the enjoyments of the skin. And so then they're going to invite a child who that's what they're into. So I understand that. But the parents should understand that, and then the parents and teachers can work together to overcome that. But when the parents are so damn proud of their you know, their sex life, then how can any teacher help? How can anyone help? They can't even help. You know? I mean, kids, you know, they're not even hit puberty yet, and they're just hanging out together, boys and girls. In the holy dome, yeah. And then as you have to, it's not, you have to be liberal. No, the shastras say broad-minded. Mahatma. They don't say liberal meaning you don't follow the rules and regulations. Yeah. Well, what to do? Everybody gets what they deserve, so. It'll be seen. But unfortunately, it'll just be when people are in their 70s and they'll kind of figure it out. You know, Prabhupada said it's the third generation that'll be good. Because you know? The problem with the second generation is they're connected to the first. Yeah, so that's why this... Because the second generation is very different from the first. The second generation, Krishna consciousness, is their culture and philosophy. how strictly they want to follow it or not is there. But for the first generation, they're not as sure it is or not. Right? There's very great difference between the first and second generation. First generation, many don't have faith in our own culture and all that. Second generation sees it. You know, the men are men, the women are women. First generation, it's rare to find. Rare to find. But the second generation, the boys are, they're boys, you know. You know, there's no, they're just, they're very different. Very different. What to do?
Do you give classes like this during
my class? I do, but you know, you only find East Block Wallers here. You know. Now and again, a few. You know, first world devotees. Couple, and you know, one or two temple presidents here and there. But generally, then it's you know, it'll be European, continental European. Sounds like a dog. Good. Remember, they are pure if they've just chased and caught a deer. I guess because their pure dogness is manifest, you know. It's that time they're pure dog, otherwise. We ran a session that was just meant for grihasthas. For the first 2 days, all that would be discussed, as I was trying to say, is that the Vedic principle is start with yourself. Correct yourself. When you can correct yourself, then you can actually correct others. So the whole thing is if you want to establish the Vedic culture, you have to first establish the leaders. Because the leaders then will create the facility and give the guidance how the culture can be established. That's why Prabhupada wanted to establish a class of brahmanas. Right? So if we say the Vedic culture failed, we tried it, it didn't work, is because we ourselves failed to create a class of brahmanas. Right? Like that. We failed to create that class. So now, what's the practical way you do it? You first get people to understand what is their own duties first. Then, at least you have everybody following their duties. So right there, you've created a atmosphere in which development can actually take place. Right? Because unless you have the right atmosphere, you can't do anything. You want to do something, you have to have the proper atmosphere. So first thing is everybody knows what is their conditioned nature and how it's engaged in the Lord's service. What is the process of devotional service, how it all relates. You know, what is anartha nivritti? Right? Once that's known, then from there, then those who can change themselves, then you look for those who have leadership qualities. Right? There's no use being a leader if you can't change yourself. Because if you may be able to manage, but you can't change anybody else. Right? Because otherwise, management is an art. And something that shudras can do very nicely. There are shudras who their art is management. They're very expert. But they can't give shelter to people. They can only manage. So when you see management without shelter, you're dealing with Vaishyas or Shudras. But a good Vaishya, you know, will give some shelter because he wants his profit. You know? And a good Shudra, if he doesn't want to be fired, he has to at least deal nicely with the people enough so that, you know, they don't get upset. Otherwise his boss will kick him out. Right? Because generally he'll be hired by, you know, Brahmins, or Vaishyas, or like that. Otherwise the Kshatriya, he's going to shelter himself. He doesn't need them to do it. But in any case, the people are sheltered. So then you see, therefore, who has qualities and can lead, right? Because the Brahmins and Kshatriyas in the Gita are distinguished by qualities, not by work, right? You don't see Krishna saying one bit of work on how you identify a Brahmana, or one bit of work on how you identify a Kshatriya. He says, what are qualities? Then when he gets to Vaishyas, he says, these are the work they do. And then he says, in Shudras, they serve the others. Because to do business, you don't have to have good qualities. You need a little sense control, otherwise you won't become very big. But you can be an absolute demon and be a businessman. But a Kshatriya, you have to have some virtue. And a Brahmin, you have to have more. So first you see who can change themselves and accept who they are. Then from amongst those, then you see who can lead. And then those leaders, then you divide them into two groups. Those who can actually hands-on manage and organize the facilities, and those who can advise and teach. But during that conversation for 2 days, it was always, well, you know, even I changed myself, unless you get the managers together, unless you get the MAC together, unless you get the GBC, and unless you get the this one, the directors. 2 days I had to fight that. Finally they accepted, okay, we got to change ourselves. And after that point, you saw a lot of these persons left. They didn't come to anymore. Because it wasn't interesting. You know, we were not leader bashing. You know, there was no issues. The issue was, is I'm not Krishna conscious. I'm not my, because my ego, I'm not accepting who I am. My conditioned nature. Like that. And then after that, then he stayed some days. And then it kind of stopped. You know? And I did it in the Grihastha community. I didn't do it here at the Gurukul. I did it right in one of the houses over there. Very few people come. And it was a time of year also when not very many are here. You know? You know, but when do you find the right time? They just come back in Kartik. Then they're busy kind of getting the whole scene together like that. And then you got a short time, and then it's busy with the festival, and then they're busy leaving. You know? So it's hard to find a time. But we should have faith in what Prabhupada established, what he said. And we have to get there. Otherwise, then what's the meaning? What's the use? Right? Somehow the idea is right now, as if there's money, and if there was good karmi education, and everybody has a nice job where they can get money, the next generation, all social problems will go away. You know? But if that was true, then why is it there's still so much problem in the first world countries? You know? And there's hundreds of thousands of people who have degrees are unsatisfied, who have money are unsatisfied, who have jobs are unsatisfied. They forget that that's why they became devotees. They forget. If everything was so wonderful, they wouldn't have become a devotee. They were so satisfied and everything was so perfect. No, they were dissatisfied. The whole system. I mean, that was the whole hippie thing. Is you have all these people who are going for the status quo, and it's so false, so superficial. And then suddenly now, devotees are saying, well, unless you follow the status quo and go for all those things that the karmis go for, then how you can be satisfied? It's all because the kids are saying. But the kids, they didn't train them. What were the values? Didn't train them. There's no one supports the system. Otherwise, then the real thing would be, you go around, talk to all those Gurukul kids, tell them, okay, what did you feel did give you benefit? What did you like? Anything. Just even if it's the simplest thing, just somebody dealt with you in a particular way, or you did an activity, or, you know, the way the room was, or the class, or anything. Just what, look back, what did you like? What did you find was of value? What was it that you experienced that you would want to see that the next generation of children experiences? You know, they know what they don't, what they would like to change, but what was it was good? What gave them if there is any, even a fraction of a moment of a good memory, what was it? You know, just they were with other kids and having a good time, or, you know, one teacher dealt with them in a particular way, or they liked a particular subject, or find that out.
I think that's the way to go, to work with those.
Yeah. Then you take that, and then you look at, okay, you know, are you maintaining these things in the school? You know, is that being maintained? How can we cultivate that? Because it's very obvious what, you know, it's obvious to me what went wrong. Is the teachers didn't give shelter, and the parents wouldn't let the teachers work. But I haven't seen that come up. You know, they use newer age terminologies, you know, the care and affection, but no one's talking shelter. Because the care and affection without shelter is just bodily or mentally. But that still does not create emotional satisfaction. Because shelter means duty. Duty creates emotional satisfaction. So even when we take this new age slant, still no one will be satisfied. Because it's still below the standard. It's still pranamoy. It's not only when you hit manamoy, then there's emotional satisfaction. And since devotees are yelling and screaming for it, then they should follow the process to get it. But they accept the sub-dharma, sub-religious principles, you know, that's what everybody taught. Anyone non-Vedic taught sub-religious, they never taught religious. Buddha never taught religious, he rejected the Vedas. Jain never taught the religious, they taught sub-religious, be nice, be good, be non-violent. You know, Jesus taught sub-religious. You know, they all taught sub-religious. Just be nice, be good, don't steal. You know? Like this. They couldn't really get to the standard of that. You're just trying to take animals and make them into, bring them as close to human as possible. So sub-religious can be understood because it's very close to sense gratification. But instead of my sense gratification, it's someone else's sense gratification. So I can work for that. And they mistake the emotional platform as spiritual, right? You know, if somehow or another, you know, a boy and girl have a nice experience where they really care for each other for a moment, it's called spiritual. No, in the Vedic, that was just called material emotion. That was supposed to be a constant platform. And spiritual was something else. You know, way beyond that. So it's the perfection, the rare moment in the modern new age system and what all this mumbo jumbo that everyone talks about, that was the normal platform of the Vedic culture. That was just normal dealings. The emotions that were there between parents and kids and this. And I saw in Calcutta, I was riding on the metro. This is what I mean. If you know what, if you have an understanding of what to look for, you can still see it happening in India. Riding on the metro, then
there was some people, they came in on there, you know, and everything's full. And then, you know, one of the mothers was there with a whole group of ladies together. They came on together. And they were standing over on the side where, right next to the door, where you have enough place for three people to sit. And there was already one lady was, I think one of the ladies got to sit there, one of the older ladies got to sit there, and there was another two men who were together. They were sitting there. And, you know, the man was probably like in his 30s, mid or late 30s, by the looks of it. And, you know, the women are there. And then there's a little kid. I don't remember if it was a boy or a girl.
A boy.
It was a boy. Then, you know, there's no place to sit. The place is packed. So then one of the men calls the boy over and just kind of like leans him against his lap, you know, so he doesn't have to stand like that. And the mother's happy and they're all there like this and that. And he just sits there, and when the, you know, kid gets restless, you know, he knows how to just touch and push and poke all in the ways to keep the kid happy. And then at some point, you know, kids are restless. Then after a few minutes of that, then he gets up and walks back over to his mother. And then after, you know, another couple of minutes, comes back and sits with this man, you know. The woman didn't know the man, you know. The kid didn't know the man. But in the Vedic culture, adult parents know children. So it doesn't matter if it's their children or anyone's children. They're a tattva. And the parental rasa is any child you take care of. Therefore, every woman is mother. Every child is a child of, like, the community. And everyone deals. No, but because they know, they can see who they're dealing with, because they know the thing. Now, if that happened in our society, someone did that, that person, that man, would have been reported to the CPT.
Yes.
And then they talk about love and trust and caring for the kids. It's demoniac. They have no idea what is parental ras. It's reduced down to the lowest common bare, even a family, you know, it means, you know, like the nuclear family is supreme, and they have the sole rights on how to raise a child. It's become so animalistic, you know. They're not even social animals anymore, you know. Even the karmis say humans are a social animal. But, you know, we're not allowed to be social animals. Because first they don't know what is parental ras, so they can't recognize it. You have to know it to recognize it. Right? Like a good manager can spot potential management in somebody new. You know? You know, a good athlete can spot, you know, potential in that. A good teacher can spot the intellectual abilities in a student. Like this. So a good parent can spot parental ras in someone else. That person didn't have that. There's no question that they would allow their kid to go near that person. No question. But because they can see the way the person sits, deals, looks. And you could see. They come over there. It could have been their son. The way they dealt. The way they hold on to them and this and that. And the way they know is as soon as the kid gets restless, they walk off. Right? Kids are like that. They come, they sit with you, and then you give them all affection. The parent could sit there and give affection for hours like that. But the kid's restless. They're independent. They just get up and walk off. You know? Because it's totally one way. You know? When they want some, they come around. When they don't, they walk off. And they could see. So the culture's still there, alive and well. It's happening today. So devotees may say, well, what Prabhupada talks about is dead and gone, you know? Some of them will, most liberal will say, okay, you know, at the turn of the century when Prabhupada was a kid, okay, it was functioning then. Most liberal. Less liberal is, okay, at the time of Lord Chaitanya, it was functioning. And then, you know, more common is Vedic culture died 5,000 years ago and hasn't been seen since, I hope. But someone who has faith in what Prabhupada says can go out today, and if they know where to look, they can still see everything Prabhupada talks about happening today.
right now.
When I come on the train, so many men want to forget their place to me because,
yeah,
sit down. But brahmacharis wouldn't do that.
No, no.
They wouldn't give me a place to sit.
No, they won't, because they're not trained.
Yeah.
They're not trained. But you'll see probably also our grihastha men won't give it either. Because they think they're the boss of women. I've seen is like that. Is brahmacharis don't give because they're overly sensitive to the women, like that, and they just freak out. They just kind of like, you know, their brain just like freezes and they don't know what to do. But it's because of sensitivity. But the grihastha men won't give because of over familiarity. Yeah, we know the women, or you know, they control the women, this and that. They deal rough with the women. I mean, for all they're saying this and that about the brahmacharis, the men deal much rougher with the women, the grihastha men. Much rougher. The brahmacharis just don't know what to do, but they're sensitive. You know? But, so, generally, it means Indians won't have a problem, but generally the Westerners will overreact and become very harsh externally. But internally, you can see they're just freaked out. But the grihastha men, they're really confident that they really know what they're doing. Like that. So it's if there's anyone who can be trained how to deal properly with women very quickly, it's going to be the brahmacharis and the sannyasis, because they're already sensitive. When a woman is in the room, they know. So they're sensitive. And that's the first principle, that if you want to deal, you have to be sensitive to the other person. But the grihasthas aren't sensitive. Though they say they are, they're not. I've watched. I've seen. There was a couple here at the festival. It's sense gratification, and they think they're control. They're the guru. They're in charge. They're the boss. But they don't give the shelter. So it's very difficult. And, you know, I saw there was one brahmachari here. Doesn't know anything about anything like this. Then it's decided he's going to get married to one of the ladies here. She's got a son in this gurukul. You know, the day that they kind of like decide that, he's the big authority on how to run kids. And he's telling all the gurukul teachers, you do this wrong, you do that wrong, you do all this wrong. It's kind of like, well, hey, yesterday weren't you just a bozo brahmachari? And now today, you know, now he's the big, you know, realized, experienced grihastha. You know, then they pulled the kid out of the school because now he can experience a family. Like that. Guy was home, and after a while the brahmachari walked off, you know, and then left the mother with the kid who's not in the gurukul. And the gurukul won't take the kid back because the kid's become so wild. They don't want to deal with the guy. And the mother's freaking out. You know? All because of, you know, just because you're grihastha, then you're expert at dealing with children. Or if they just left the kid in the school, tried to get their own relationship together, you know, then what did they show the kid? Mother blew it already with one man, brings in another man, oh, come home and see this new wonderful man. Oops, what happened? Right? And then, so now the kid's seen the mother blow it with two husbands, you know, wants to get in the gurukuls, they won't let him in. So whose fault is it? But in the books, it'll go down as the school's fault. The schools will be blamed. Mother won't be blamed. That so-called, you know, whatever it was, you know, six-month father won't be blamed. You know, the grihastha community that allows him to run around like a madman and pierce his ears and hang out with the girls won't be blamed. You know? The temple management, you know, had a brahmachari in the top. That'll be blamed. You know, or because we had a sannyasi as a director. That, he'll be blamed. You know? Or the gurukul, because it's run by brahmacharis and stuff. They'll be blamed. Grihasthas are squeaky clean. I mean, they're squeaky clean. They cannot be touched. They're above the law. Like that. And they weren't even married. It was just mutual consent, you know. That's all it takes nowadays. Just de facto is good enough. You're an authority on parental rasa due to mutual consent, right? And that's what it says in the Bhagavatam. Men and women will just live together due to mutual consent. It's right in the 12th canto. You know? And the sages hearing this are like, wow, I mean, this is so demoniac. They can't believe it. Such things would happen. But our own devotees follow it. It's fine. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many other reasons. We're speaking on this one side to make a point. I understand devotees have come from difficult backgrounds. They weren't trained. They're going to go through so many problems. And, you know, they can't figure out many times the first marriage, and they, you know, figure out a little more in the second marriage, and, you know, a third time's a charm, you know. So I understand that. But they shouldn't be proud. They shouldn't be proud. Because if they took, you know, 30 years and three marriages to figure out how to run the Grihastha ashram, you know, then they have to give, you know, the leaders and the teachers and everybody else that space also. They have to give that space also. But what to do?
I'm sure we can also start explaining to other people this language.
Mm. Because the thing is, the Grihastha ashram has to be actually cultivated and nourished from the Grihastha ashram. Like that. You know, the teachers, the leaders can only you know, support that training and that facility. But it has to come from inside. You know, it has to come from inside. But then you have to have, you have the ashram itself has to be trained. And devotees just have to be, that's the whole purpose of the Brahmacharya ashram, is that you become observant of what's around you. Because when a boy stays in the house, then they take everything for granted. Absolutely everything for granted. You know, that they have a place to sleep, you know, that there's going to be clothes, there's going to be food. They just take it for granted. They don't think anything about who they are, what's going on, how it's happening. Nothing at all. So when you put them in the school, but they have to be trained through the parental rasa. They have to get nourished from the parental rasa. So then they're getting the physical nourishment, but the other aspects, some of the basic emotional, they're getting from the mother and the support from the father. So fundamentals are being done. The fundamentals aren't enough. You have to know the technique. You have to be conscious of what's going on if you actually want to be take part. So then that has to be taught by the teacher. So then the child must be learned to become conscious of what's around him. Therefore, then he starts doing menial service, working himself, and he actually understands what is going on. He washes his own clothes, he cleans the ashram, all those things that, you know, his mother was doing for him. Then he realizes what is going on. You know, then he understands what a debt he owes to his mother and father, because they took care and did all these things for him. But he becomes conscious of the world around him. In the house, he'll never become conscious. At most, he'll become conscious of, who are the girls out there. That's it. They can't become conscious of more than that. Outside. They won't become. So they become conscious of this, and then you can train them in the levels of consciousness, what are their duties, to be dutiful, to be respectful, and all by their own, determination, rather than just by habit. Because habit may change. If it doesn't become conscious, they may be very nice when they're with the parents. But if they get in other association, they may change. They're with the parents, they're nice. They're with the other people who are not nice, they're not nice. But if it's conscious, if they're with people who are not nice, they will leave that association. They won't be changed by it. So therefore, they go to the house of the teacher, and the teacher is in the parental rasa and takes care. Like that. So the emotional platform, they give that input. They may not give the same physical as the parents. But the emotional platform is the same. And then they get trained. And when they get big enough, then they grow up, then they can go back to the parents. And then they can become an actual part of the community. Because now they're conscious of the values of the community. So that's the system. But if it's not understood, like now there's human, you know, at least now they say, okay, we've unqualified those who do at least support some aspect of the educational system. We're considering sending their kids at all to the educational system, whether it's day school or boarding. Then they say we must have qualified teachers. But the qualification for the teacher is simply academic, that you know how to teach in the classroom. That's all they teach. And then if you're going to, you know, run a school, okay, then you learn some management techniques. But no one's taught how to train a teacher to be a parent. What is the parental ras? How to deal with the psychology of a child? That no one talks about. Not even amongst the educationalists do they talk about this. They just don't talk about it. It's not talked about. Yeah, he's emphasizing because he grew up in it. He grew up in it. So because he grew up in it, then he's able to establish that. So that's why he gets results. That's why the children are happy. You know? I mean, it's like last year, a whole bunch of kids just unqualified to be in the school, you know, so he removed them from the school. You know, his kids are still coming back today, you know, 6 months later, still trying to get into some school. They just like being in Gurukul. And these were rascals. So that means he's doing something right. Because Vrindavan had rascals in their school, and they hated the system. They were glad to get out of there. The Vedasara's rascals, they want to get into the school. How come it's dark like that? There's no ghee in there, is there?
No, it's the oil.
It's just a little cold.
I don't know, it's just how the oil looks like.
This is the palm oil?
No, there's the rapeseed.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, we didn't get the palm yet. Okay. Like that. Because he's grown up in a system like that. Though in his last article, he didn't acknowledge that. I was a little disappointed. But I was impressed that he actually thought we had an administration. I was impressed with that. Like that. The only reason he does the things he does is because he grew up in it. Because he was not consciously taught those things. Chandrasekhar was taught, who was the principal before him. He wasn't taught. So he's doing these out of habit from what he saw. Most of the discussion is not on how to apply it as how to just trying to convince devotees that they should follow it. You know? The main discussion should be going how to apply it. Because then the discussion goes slightly in a different way. You know? Like, basically, our presentation going through all this Manasamhita, in most cases, is showing how it's proper, it's in Prabhupada's books, or explaining that it's all right, it's not bad. Very rare do we get into actually how you apply that, you know. You know, what is its... I mean, sometimes we explain the purpose. We explain the purpose to show that it's okay. You know, but very rare there's discussion of how to actually implement it in the life. There's very few that are interested, that even see it. It's so subtle. Most don't see that it's actually a workable system. It's just so subtle. You know, it's like when you think of martial arts, you think of all the rough and ready ones, you know? Smack the guy or this or that. But even in the rough ones, when you get up to the very high levels, you know, then they get into the subtle, the meditative and the life energies. Even the roughest, heaviest systems, they always, like when they cross like fourth dan, then they start getting to the subtleties, you know? Like that. Even past the second, but past the fourth or sixth, then it gets really serious. And by the eighth, then they just work on the energies. So then, if you have a system that starts from the beginning on the just working on the life energies, most people don't consider it a martial art. It's not something you think about, you know, because it's just too subtle. It doesn't attract many people like that. In fact, many times in that those subtle systems, they won't even take people until they're 30 years old. Because only by that time the brain is kind of mature enough and they become peaceful enough that they can actually appreciate and use the system. So the Vedic system is the most sophisticated. It's the top of Manamoy, of religious principles. It's the material religious principles. It's the top. You can't get a finer system than that. And within this fine system, then our acharyas have picked out of it the essence of that, which is even more subtle. It's directly connected to the conclusions. And then devotees don't see that it's something practical. You know? Like devotees who go to any management book except Bhagavatam. No one looks in the Bhagavatam how to train or create a manager. Well, the Bhagavatam just again and again, story after story, shows the qualities and how they grew up and what was their training and everything. I haven't heard one management class talk about that. Not one. None. Like that. They never think. Because it's just, well, that's philosophy, not practical. Practical has got to be something else, you know. Either I figured it out myself or somebody else has, or some karmi has figured it out. But it's never that the Bhagavatam, because it's in the form of Purana, that is the practically applied philosophy. This is what we can learn from. This is what we should be doing. Oh no, because there the leaders wear crowns and wear swords and, you know, shoes with, you know, curls on the front, so we can't learn anything from them. Because that to them is what a manager is. It's simply what is on the outside. It's the shell of a manager. There's no management course on the planet that actually teaches the Vedic, what the Vedics offers as them, you know, that everything in the kingdom is your child. Prabhupada even, you know, got on Bhavananda's case that there were some banana trees that weren't getting enough water. And he said, you're in charge here, so these banana trees are under your care, and if they're not getting water, it's your fault. Like that. So that you learn. Learning that. You have big manager. What's his name? Runti Dev, fasting for 40 days. Then all these people come in and he gives. Right? No, us, our big leaders, they'll eat. You know, no one else eats. That's, you know, someone else's problem. You know? Leader eats. You go to any temple, leaders generally eating okay. You look at how the serving is and what the prasad is for the devotees, it's terrible. You know? But I mean, Bhagavatam doesn't give that example. You know? It doesn't give that example. You know? How you choose a leader. It's right there in the Bhagavatam. Maharaj Uttanapada, how did he choose Dhruva Maharaj to be the next king? First he looked if he had qualities. Did he have personal good qualities? When he saw he had personal good qualities, he was satisfied. Then he went to the elders. What did they think? Because they got to work with him if he's going to be the king. They also were satisfied with him. Then that's still not enough. Then he checked what the people thought. Not in a democratic way with the vote, but they know how to test and find out what is people's opinion. And when he found the people were happy with it, then he was installed. So is that how our temple presidents are put in? I know the last two, maybe previous two GBCs, how they were picked for France. Why? They were gentle and wouldn't get in the way of anybody. That was it. At the same time, they're blamed for not being great managers, but that's not the reason they picked them. They picked them because they weren't going to be heavy. That was it. You know, they spoke nicely, sweetly. They were Indians. They were old. Good chance they weren't blue, right? So I mean, everything's so external. So external. But the Bhagavatam gives what substance. You know? You gotta deal with the material nature, so this is how you deal. Very nice. And nothing's left out, you know? Nothing's left out. You know? There on today, how Grihastha deals with his meal, not only as a leader, as a Grihastha. You know? Like that. You know, even they get down to the most popular of popular subjects, just sex life. The Bhagavatam goes through what is proper, what is improper, what is the results of the children. Improper, you get Hiranyakashipu, Hiranyaksha. Proper, you get Vamanadeva, Kapila Muni. They show couples how they go through the whole thing of how Kardama got married, how he was an Upakurvana Brahmachari, how he got married, what were the considerations, how the whole dealings were, how the father dealt with the daughter, father with the wife, how he dealt with the son-in-law. I mean, all these things are shown there. But devotees, oh, that's Bhagavatam, that's philosophy. They'll never think that here is something practical. Or Chaitanya Charitamrita. No, it's never. How many temples around the movement cook bitter? You know? How many cook spinach? You never see these things. You know? So, I mean, Chaitanya Charitamrita is like, you know, one third of it is just menus and what they fed Lord Chaitanya and how they served it and the order they served it in. But has any devotee ever thought, hey, why don't we do this? No. It never happens. Serving prasad, Prabhupada showed very much how to serve. You know? How to serve. What is the technique of serving? Like that. You can go around the movement. You can't find one place that knows anything about serving. You know? In most places, then they just, you know, stick a bunch of buckets there, you know, with some spoons sticking at them. You go up and get it yourself. If they're a little bit more sophisticated, then they have a devotee sitting there and comes and gives it to you. You know? And that's considered top of the line. You know? Isn't it? Yeah. I mean, been around.
The seagull system.
Huh?
The seagull system.
Seagull system.
How is it supposed to be?
Huh? Devotees, like this, we sing Bhaja Bhakata Vatsala. There. Devotees sit down in the line. People come by and serve. Mm-hmm. Like that. They serve how much people want, how much they need, knowing what people want, give this and that. You know, and they serve until everyone's satisfied. Then the servers sit down. And now it's you go around once, you come back immediately, give again. But, you know, 30 seconds later, who wants more of the same prep? So you go, oh, nobody wants anything. Then you make your plate and sit down. You know? And then 2 minutes later they want, but then there's no service there. So either they get up and the next guy that just happens to walk in the room, hey, give me this, that, and then they know. So then no one wants to go through all that. So then you just put all the buckets on the side, you know, and everybody comes and just pulls and takes what they want and takes it here, takes it there and that. Right? And I mean, there's a, you know, what English saying, the family that eats together stays together, right? Most of the time, no one eats together. It's just, it's there, you know. Some more sophisticated, then they put a microwave oven there. So when you come 2 hours later, you can put it in there, stick it in there, push the button. Yeah. Yeah, then you microwave it. God only knows what happens to it. I don't know how much Krishna appreciates that. So it's culture is just not taken. It's not understood. It's not maintained. What Prabhupada gave devotees told me, like he established art, you know, he established drama, established music.
In the old days we took a lot more of culture that Prabhupada gave than now.
It gets all dropped because it's too refined. You know, how many devotees, even as a karmi, you know, grew up going to operas and how you say, you know, orchestras, performance of classical music, and, you know, dealt with art and drama, you know, went to theaters and stuff like that. How many? Very few. So they can't appreciate what Prabhupada gave. I think we better stop. I think we're getting some grumbling from the side. Om Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.